today on Boston Public Radio. Is it Justice Department policy until it wasn't? The administration was following the law by separating families. That was until separating families wasn't required by law. It was put in place to be a deterrent, then it wasn't. Could not be reversed by executive order until it was yesterday. Or was it? We talked to Meet the Press's Chuck Todd about Trump's ever-changing position on immigration. Then we'll open the lines and ask you about Trump reversing his executive order. Is this too little too late? And will Trump pay a political price?
The president says migrant children will no longer be separated from their parents, but is detention purgatory with their parents that much better? We'll ask Gil Kerlikowske, former Customs and Border Protection Commissioner under the Obama administration. Then we continue the conversation with Art Kaplan, who's leading a petition among his fellow ethicists to put an end to the practice of breaking up families at the border. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm Henry Santoro. This is WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Tim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Happy summer, Marjorie.
Thank you.
So if there's one thing everybody can agree on, Donald Trump is a media mastermind. He knows how to exploit it. He has a perverse instinct for how people react to it. But this time, it appears he got it wrong, failing to anticipate how photos of young boys locked up in cages and video of toddlers sobbing because border agents were taking them away from their parents would outrage everyone, or at least just about everyone. Now that he's finally got the message, has he effectively been able to manipulate this?
Today, I signed an executive order. We're going to keep families together, but the border is going to be just as tough as it's been. Democrats don't care about the impact of uncontrolled migration on your communities, your schools, your hospitals, your jobs or your safety. Democrats put illegal immigrants before they put American citizens. What the hell is going on? And the Democrats' open border policies have also allowed MS-13 to break into our country and drugs to pour into our streets, and we're stopping it.
Exactly. What the hell is going on? Joining us for his take on this and other headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. He also hosts the Meet the Press daily on MSNBC. Marjorie texted me during every minute of it yesterday. And the political director, even though I have another job, political director of NBC News. Hey there, Chuck Todd.
Hi, Chuck Todd.
Hey. How you doing?
Good. Well, I just want to say, before we begin, you had a great montage yesterday on your show showing everybody lying. You know, the Sarah Sanders, Nielsen, the president. I can say this. You probably won't. Fox News has been lying, too. We tried to steal it for ourselves, but we couldn't do it. So the president has, of course, signed an executive order, which he said he couldn't do. So what does this order do?
Well, the order right now makes it so that they will keep, you still have a zero tolerance policy at the border, you're crossing the border illegally, you're going to get prosecuted. But when you're held, if you've come with your child will be held with you. Now, here are the details we don't know. Held in the same facility or held in the same room, right? We don't know those things. What we also don't know, what's the reunification process for the kids that have already been separated from their parents? That's another thing that as of last night, we got one answer from the government that maintained that, you know, that they were more focused on implementing the policy going forward. And then when they realized how cold-hearted that sort of came across, they're trying to figure out the process of reunification. So the fact is the president is right about one thing, all right, in that they still need a congressional fix here. Okay, the lawsuit, the courts have already said you can't detain a child for more than 20 days. So if you're going to detain that child with his parents, the 20-day issue is still an issue unless Congress gives a little more relief, creates maybe a 90-day issue, and you have more immigration judges, which, of course, the president himself said last night, no judges. You know why he doesn't want judges? He don't want anybody to be allowed to come in. You know, one of the things that I think has been way under reported here is when the president says railed against the Ted Cruz compromise, which simply was that calling for the hiring of more judges to handle the asylum cases. He didn't want judges. Well, why don't you want more judges? Because you don't want any asylum cases ruled in favor of asylum. He doesn't want anybody to come in here. And I think that that's the part of this story that has been totally missed. Like, why is he against increasing the number of judges to deal with the backlog of asylum seekers? Well, I think we know the answer.
You know, can we, before we get to Congress and what they're going to do or not do here, Chuck Todd, the two issues you
It's always not do. It is always not do with them, remember.
I want to examine the two things you said about the executive order yesterday, working backwards. One, at the end of the 20 days, unless the court revises its policy, which I guess the Trump administration is requesting or is about to request.
And they may get temporary relief because there is a, you know, this is we have an overwhelming number at this time of year right now because of the total deterioration of governments in Central America.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. This is there is a source of this. But anyway, go ahead, Jeff.
But to comply with the order, correct me if I'm wrong, if it isn't change and there isn't temporary relief, they would have to separate a kid from his or her parent or guardian all over again. Would they not after 20 days?
No, I think after 20 days, they have to find, they have to make an every effort to find a place for that kid. It's not in government custody, meaning find a relative, find, and that's,
okay.
And that's, okay, and that's where the harder line advocates here who want a really tough policy say that's the loophole, and that's the loophole that's got to be closed, right? That's the child loophole here that is still bringing people into the country, and so that's, that's why that's an issue for some who would like the tightest controls possible when it comes to immigration.
And one other thing that you mentioned vis-a-vis the 2,300 plus or minus kids in reunification, I guess two things. One, is it guaranteed? I know there have been conflicting statements from Health and Human Services and others last night. Is it guaranteed that there will be an effort? And two, if the answer to that is yes, is there? We have Gil Karlikowski here at noon, who obviously ran Border Patrol under Barack Obama. Is it clear that they have the ability to reunite these people and where they'd put them together, even if they chose to?
Well, look, it's the second part of the question that I think is the harder one to answer. I don't know if they have the ability to do it. The first part is right now, it's not clear that it's not clear how much they're prioritizing reunification. But even if they prioritize it, let's be realistic, this isn't going to be, I think this is going to be quite difficult. Hopefully there was some system. They already admitted they've lost track of, I mean, going back to the Obama administration, they've lost track of thousands of kids in this system. So, I don't have a lot of confidence that the reunification process will be successful even if prioritized, simply because it seems as if they didn't have a good system in place. And frankly, it's probably very difficult. I mean, look, we had one reporter who went down to the border tell me a story of one kid who came across with his sister because his mom died during the trek. You know, what people forget is these people are fleeing in distress. They're fleeing because right now it is a war zone in parts of Honduras. Right now it is really bad in parts of El Salvador. And they're fleeing, and this trek is life-threatening. And then, so by the time they get to the border, you know, their family units have been reconstituted in different ways. Older sisters taking care of their young kids because their parents either got separated from them or got harmed or hurt or had to go back. And so it's not clear who belongs to who at times. And then you'll have and I think that's made it even that much more difficult to keep track of these people and then keep track when you're separating them out, who belongs to who. So it isn't easy when you're doing it with heart, okay? It isn't easy when you want to do it right, let alone perhaps some people who are not even incentivized to get it done right.
But Chuck Todd, to me, the toothpaste is out of the tube now. Now that we know that the vast majority of Americans can't tolerate children and babies being taken away from their parents.
Except for a majority of Republicans who can.
Well, But the majority of Americans cannot. And the president obviously saw the polling numbers and saw his own base beginning to back away from him. I think it's going to be very difficult for the president to get anywhere near what he wants on immigration, because the good journalists are going to keep reporting the stories of the families murdered in El Salvador and the children coming here and the reunification problems. You have a story that Jim referred to of the kids coming to New York City, unbeknownst to Mayor de Blasio. Right. One of them as young as 9 months old. We're going to have continuing stories about this disaster. So I don't know how you get tough again in this climate. Politically.
Well, and it's called the ballot box. I mean, you know, what I would say here is, and I had a conservative make this claim to me, and I actually agree with him. This conservative said, you know, if Republicans hold on to the House and Senate in November, it's going to be a mandate for dealing with border security. And I said, you know what? I said, that's a fair statement. If for some reason Republicans do hold on to control of Congress, I do think we will say, you know what, the immigration was a powerful way to rally the Republican base. But I also believe if Democrats win both the House and Senate, it will also be a sign that healthcare should be prioritized. That it is, if you're looking at it as sort of which policy priority does the American public want to see? You know, which policy does the American public want to see prioritized? If Democrats take control of Congress, I think we'll conclude it's because Republicans messed around too much with health care. If Republicans hold on, then I do think Democrats are going to have to say to themselves, wait a minute, we're out of touch on the immigration issue. So if you're asking me, when does the president feel as if he can go back to it? First of all, it's what got him elected. He's always going to go back to it. He's going to constantly be on it. But whether he has political opportunity to do something on the policy front on it, I think only depends on what happens in November.
Yeah, I still want to get back to what Congress will do or won't do in your estimation. But following up on what you and Marjorie were just talking about, the politics, most of us, I think, including the two of us in the studio, thought the attack on Keyser Khan and his wife after the convention,
that was going to be a bridge too far.
The embarrassment of criticizing
attacking John McCain would be
John McCain, Access Hollywood, Serge Kovaleski, the disabled investigative reporter for the New York Times, and obviously none were a bridge too far. We were talking before we talked to you, Chuck, about how the kids are a whole different thing, particularly when you have the images and sound we do. Do you think they are a different thing, or shall this too pass?
No, I think this was different. It's why he had to act. It's the first guardrail that's been erected.
Uh-huh.
We've been talking about the guardrails, right? This is the first guardrail. And so you ask, okay, how did it get erected? How did he lose Ted Cruz, right? He lost Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz actually came up with an emergency bill that was extraordinarily reasonable, would have gotten bipartisan support if it had been necessary. And by the way, that guy he is a data-driven guy. He doesn't do anything with his gut or his heart. It is always poll tested. So that told me if this didn't play well in Texas, this wasn't playing well anyway, right? So we saw the first guardrail erected in the Donald Trump presidency, and it's the picture of kids, I think 100%, and I think there's a bit of incompetence here too. I also think this is a story that finally showcased, you know, there's those of us in the press have been saying this administration never tells a straight story. They're never telling you the straight story. How often do we have to explain that to you? And this story exposed it in its rawest form, right? And I think that, you know, there is a potential, and I've seen a few people say this, and I'm always a little hesitant to say something is so-and-so's Katrina or something is so-and-so's this, but you know, Katrina was sort of the exclamation point on incompetency when it came to running the Iraq war. It was sort of like, oh, wow, they really messed up handling the Iraq war. Man, these guys just don't know how to do anything right, right? Katrina was this reminder. They can't do anything right domestically or internationally. And is this the moment, is it this story is the moment that sort of crystallized for the middle of the electorate, like, oh, wow, these guys, their lies finally caught up to them. right? They're lying. Oh, by the way, they're kind of incompetent too. You know, incompetency is as lethal of a political problem as anything you can have. And there's something about the mishandling of this by the Trump administration that looks as much incompetent as it does heartless. And the combination of the two can be lethal.
So,
right? Katrina was that. It felt heartless and incompetent.
So before you go, what is Congress going to do there, Chuck Todd?
Well, today we're going to see them fail spectacularly on their immigration bills, right, on the House. They're going to try to do a couple immigration bills. Those are going to, on their own, those will fail spectacularly. I do think you will have a probably driven by the Senate, but you are going to have some sort of compromise that gives more tools to DHS and DOJ. And when I say more tools, it means more immigration judges. I'll be curious to see how Trump handles it. But I do think you'll see some corrective action just specifically to deal with this crisis at the border.
So Chuck Todd from NBC, a little gossip before you go. Mark Meadows and House Speaker Paul Ryan got into a screaming match on the House floor, pointing at each other's chests and stuff. What was going on there?
Well, this is what the Freedom Caucus does, right? This was about the compromise immigration bill, the bill that Ryan is endorsing, right? There's two immigration bills they're voting on. One is a hardline one that Meadows and the Freedom Caucus, it's called Goodlatte. It's named after the guy in the Judiciary Committee chair who wrote it. The Goodlatte bill, that's a bill that, you know, probably can't get 40 votes in the United States Senate. But it's very much more of a base-driven, you know, hardline one. Then the Speaker Ryan compromise is a compromise between the moderates, gives DACA a pass to citizenship for Dreamers, right, with the president's wall and some cutting back on some legal immigration. Now, what Meadows didn't like is that he felt as if there was too much. They were, quote unquote, it was too much of a compromise and it was, quote, bridge too far. But this is what happens. If Republicans refuse to reach out to Democrats, then they're going to be held hostage by Mark Meadows. If they don't like being held hostage by Mark Meadows, reach out to the Democrats. This is the choice they've made. They've decided to try to run the country with just one political party. It can't be done. It's why nothing's gotten done.
Hey, Chuck, before you leave, isn't there some cockamamie commercial with you in it with a basketball? Is that true?
Wasn't that there? Was last year.
I know.
That
so
was last year.
Okay. So based on,
I don't have it this year. It's going to be this year, man. It's going to be showing up my slap shot.
Well, but
excellent.
We are the kings of hockey here, of the world here in Washington D.C., brother.
But that just came back to me in my head because of your Ted Cruz thing. So Kimmel couldn't beat him.
Oh,
could
gosh.
You?
Oh my God! Please. I would dribble left-handed. I'm right-handed. I promised to only dribble left-handed against him, and I think I'd beat him.
Fair enough. That's what we were hoping was the answer.
If he's listening, I want it. I want that bad. I'll do it only left-handed, too. Bring it on.
Chuck, thanks a lot, Chuck.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you next week.
All right, guys.
Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. You do not want to miss it. He's also the host of my second favorite show, Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC. It's on every day during the week, 5 o'clock on Channel 37 on most local providers. And Chuck is also political director for NBC News.
This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH, made possible thanks to listener contributions. Your support of just $10 or $20 a month keeps all these great conversations coming your way. Please take a moment to give now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424.
Okay, we ready?
We are ready, Marjorie.
Listen to this. You are invited to embark on the exclusive WGBH Curiosity Cruise.
What is it?
With the Curiosity Desk, Edgar B.
Herwig III.
Yes. It is this really fun time. It leaves from Long Wharf on Saturday, September 8th. Drinks, tasty bites, and you get all the talk about the fabled Harbor Islands, plus ghost stories, tales of mutiny, the oldest lighthouse built in America right off the coast of Boston. A pair of tickets, yours, with a gift of $220 at WGBH right now. Tickets are limited because everybody loves Edgar B. Herwig III. To secure yours now, go to 888-897-9424 or WGBH News. What are you laughing
Did
at?
Did you say Tasty Bites, Marjorie?
Tasty
what
bites.
Kind of person says Tasty Bites? Okay, so there's going to be great food. And I mean,
what
no one
say?
Talks like that.
What do you say?
Is there Tasty Bites?
Little hors d'oeuvres?
In any case, this is...
Little lobster
know,
tails?
People think we don't like doing Pledge. I love doing Pledge.
Uh-huh.
I really do. GBH and Boston Public Radio are here because somebody thought it was important to make it available to our community. For as little as $5 a month, you can become a new member here. The reason this all matters, beyond the fact that it is a huge lift for our psyches,
uh-huh.
Would you not agree when you're getting to read the names
yep.
this time? How much you love it when you read the names of people who cared enough to take time out of their day and take money out of their
yep.
pocket to support us and our colleagues? How great is that?
I'll tell you what I think is great.
What is that?
My opportunity to go on the boat with Edgar and have Tasty Bites.
Tasty Bites. Yeah, I know what you mean. So read a few.
Thanks to Kathleen in Sutton, Karen in Falmouth, James in Cohasset, Mary Ellen in Littleton. It means an awful lot to us that you take the time out of your busy day to pledge to support WGBH and everything that goes on here. And I am going on this cruise with Edgar B. Hurwitz III, and I'm going to have some tasty
bites,
Jim. And you know what?
What?
You can stay on shore.
Now, let me be clear. For the $220 gift to WGBH now, if you go to 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org, I was not listening carefully. Are the Tasty Bites included as part of the 220, or do you have to pay extra for the Tasty Bites? Can you clarify that for me?
I believe it's 220 gets you the whole thing.
Including the Tasty
you
Bites?
You may have to throw an extra $10 for the Tasty Bites. Or
actually,
you know what you'll get lousy bites.
No,
you'll get
that's not true.
Bites. You'll get leftovers from yesterday.
So
no,
if
I'm
you want
only
the Tasty
kidding.
Bites, and by the way, Edgar is a great storyteller and a great convener of stories, if that's the right word. You call 888-897-9424, go to WGBHnews.org. $220 right now, and you're on that Curiosity Cruise. I would not miss it. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. This week, after seeing images of kids locked up in cages, after hearing the wailing of toddlers being separated from their parents at the border, America said enough, and it looks like the President of the United States was listening.
We're signing an executive order I consider to be a very important executive order. It's about keeping families together while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, and border security will be equal, if not greater, than previously. So we're going to have strong, very strong borders. But we're going to keep the families together. I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated. And it continues to be a zero tolerance. We have zero tolerance for people that enter our country illegally.
So is this a concession that Trump actually got it wrong by Trump, a sign that he was actually as moved as the rest of us by the stories of these families? Or given that by the Washington Post's accounting, his administration, listen to this, changed its story about what's been going on at the border 14 times. 14 times in an attempt to try to get away with this barbaric policy. So what's your take on this, quote, reversal of the executive order, even though, as we discussed with Chuck a couple of minutes ago, it's not clear that it will even lead to reunification in all cases of the 2,300 kids and family members? And will this be the thing, as we discussed with Chuck as well, that finally creates some political damage, even with his base, for Donald Trump? 877-301-8970.
I think it's time to play the montage.
Oh, go
I've been
ahead.
Waiting for this
what
all
is
day.
It?
This is a montage. You just mentioned the Washington Post. They put
yeah.
this together. And this montage highlights the contradictions across the Trump administration regarding
okay.
their family separation policy.
Are Department of Homeland Security personnel going to separate the children from their moms and dads?
Yes, I am considering, in order to deter, I am considering exactly that.
And I hate it, but that's a Democrat bill that we're enforcing.
Family separation stands as a pretty tough deterrent.
Could be a tough deterrent.
Why would I ever create a policy that purposely does that? No.
Are you considering this a deterrent?
Yes. Hopefully people will get the message.
No, I'm not accepting the premise that we're using children as pawns in a deterrent game.
Well, that resolves that for me. 877-301-8970. By the way, a lot of America is much more charitable than Marjorie. Here's just a tweet I randomly selected. Thank you, POTUS, President of the United States, for taking critical action ending family separation at our border. Oh, that was Ivanka Trump. actually. And one of the many responses to Ms. Trump's was just, here's one tweet, Ivanka, capital letters, your dad implemented family separation. You're praising him for something that literally is his own fault. 877-301-8970. Did you say to me yesterday or 10 minutes ago with Chuck or on the phone that you, I think it was with Chuck, I don't know what it was, that your belief is because, and I guess he agrees, that kids are involved, the video, the sound, whatever, this may have a longer shelf life than all the other stuff that a lot of us thought was going to cause great damage to candidate or President Trump, which did not.
I think, obviously, that there's future stories here in these.
No, you're right about that.
What happens to these children that are now in New York City? I said before it was a nine-month-old. That I may be mistaken about that. Now I'm seeing different reports. It's a nine-year-old.
Well, still.
But in any case, that have been flown across the country. Are they going to be united? When are they going to be united, reunited with their families? I think there's a, there's going to be questions about what sort of facilities people are in. The so-called Flores ruling said that you couldn't keep children detained for more than 20 days.
Yeah.
The president, who, by the way, we didn't have him lying, but obviously he lied over and over again, saying that the Congress had to change this. It was all the Democrats' fault. And, of course, he kept denying that he could do anything about it. And then he did something about it because it was always within his ability to do something about it. Since he started it, he could end it. But in any case, I think there's going to be continuing stories about this. And I may be wrong, but I think that most people do not blame small children and do not want to see small children in internment camps.
Well, you know, one area where there was repeated reporting, relentless reporting, and not just one time and then it was over, was on Donald Trump's treatment of women. And how did that hurt him with women without a college education?
They're grown-ups. I think there's a difference.
Oh, well, that's a good point.
Because you can
point.
Always
maybe
blame the woman.
Yeah,
well,
right.
You know, she did something wrong. She was in a short skirt. She was trying to get money. She was doing – we've blamed women.
You can also say they're lying, and you can't say that you didn't hear the kids crying, that you didn't see them in cages. Those are all good points.
Well, it's
actually
hard to say that a three-year-old is a drug smuggler or a terrorist.
Well,
or
how about Ann Coulter says they're child actors, actually.
Well, you know, why anybody asks her to – participate in their shows anymore. She disgraced herself way back in 9/11 when she was talking about how some of the 9/11 widows were thrilled that their husbands were killed. I mean, who says that kind of thing?
Steve from Arlington, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling in. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
How do you? Morning. It's okay.
I don't understand why everyone was blaming the president. This policy has been in effect well before he was the president. If you're going to put the blame on anyone, put the blame on Congress. They're the ones that make the rules and set the game. He just enforces it.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, part of the reason he's blaming is because he's lied repeatedly about what he did and didn't do and what his power was. And two, I would suggest you stick around for about 30 minutes because the head of border control for Barack Obama will explain what the former president did and did not do on this front, which will probably disabuse a lot of people of what's been advanced by supporters of the president's policy, of this president's policy.
And that's a lie that is being perpetrated by the so-called Trump media, that the policy was not in place. This is a policy that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, put in place, and he just unput it in place.
And by the way, the exception to that, which I assume is what Commissioner Karakowski is going to tell us at 12 o'clock, is if a person across the border is arrested and charged with a crime,
right,
they're going to separate the kid in those circumstances. It was a drop in the bucket as compared to the rate with which this president has been doing it. But the other point you hung up, Steve, we didn't hang up on you. The other point is you're right. Congress has to act like grown-ups. If you listen to Chuck Todd a minute ago, they can't even pass their non-grown-up version of these things today. We shall see. Tim in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
I'm exhausted. I mean, he flips and flops our president 14 times. This is exhausting. I mean, can't anybody see what a big liar he is? I mean, he's not even a legitimate person.
So you're not a big fan, Tim, I think it's safe to say, huh?
Hey, Tim, before you go, do you think this one has staying power vis-a-vis Trump's base, or is this yet another issue?
Jim and Marjorie, how far back do you want to go? Well, let's start with the Access Hollywood. Once that didn't stick, everything else is just fair game. It just rolls and rolls.
No, it does.
One last thing, Marjorie.
Yes.
Hasty Bites.
We're going to get back to them in about 30 seconds, so don't go away if you want to hear more. Tim, thank you for the call.
I guess I never should have mentioned the Tasty Bites.
No, you're the one said. You said it. I didn't say it. I was just repeating what you said. Tim, thank you for your call. We're going to take more
calls
in a minute.
Okay, we are talking about Trump reversing executive order. We've got to take a quick break, but we're going to keep talking about the president's order when we come back. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
It's time to support Boston Public Radio on WGBH. Listener contributions pay for the program and keep it on the air. You don't have to give much to make a difference. Please make a difference by giving now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424.
So I'm going to try to describe this curiosity cruise from WGBH that Marjorie botched a couple of minutes ago. This is led by the Curiosity Desk.
I thought I did a fine job.
Edgar B. Herwick III. It departs Long Wharf on Saturday, September 8th. They've done this in the past. And every single person, and I mean this sincerely, with whom I have spoken who went, loved every single minute of this. Beyond the fact that it's beautiful out on the water. We used to do these at our old radio station, by the way, and they were huge fun.
Yes, we did.
And Edgar is a great leader for this kind of thing. And to get a pair of tickets, it's $220. $220 if you do it now. Tickets are limited. They're going to sell out. Trust me. You call 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org. And I can't remember, Marjorie. I know they have drinks that are available for part of the $220 price. But what else do you get? I just can't remember. Other than Edgar Herwick, great stories, great conversation, a lot of fun, beautiful water, beautiful night, September 8th. And I think I said, drinks. I can't. What else do you get?
Tasty Bites.
That's what it was. You get Tasty Bites.
Tasty Bites. Yeah, Jim remembers those cruises we used to have very fondly. Jim would have a couple of cocktails, and he really cut up the rug on that dance
floor. I did in my own way. I do not dance like you do. I'm not. I admit, on my best dancing day, I'm nowhere near you.
The whole staff
was
in awe.
Well, they weren't in awe.
There.
Okay, fine. They weren't in awe, but I did the best I could.
Okay, so it is a wonderful opportunity, but it's really an opportunity to, you know, we are on the air 24/7. Not Jim and I, obviously, but WGBH is on the air 24/7, 7 days a week. We have news going from Joe Matthew in the morning. Our show, you know, Barbara Howard in the afternoon. All the great shows. Callie Crossley and stuff. You're supporting all of that if you support us with a contribution, and we appreciate whatever you can give. We are here because you guys think that National Public Radio is important. $5 per month is all that it takes to become a new member. So please think about donating to us whatever you can give. Our number is 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. And, of course, the Harbor Island Cruise is a big incentive.
It is. And Jackie in Middleborough, you're going to like what she says. She says she gives because GBH and NPR, quote, work tirelessly in pursuit of the facts, which really matters now. We also want to thank Selena and Sharon, Stephen in Halifax, Betty in Medfield. Again, it's simple to do. You take 2 minutes, 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. It's only $5 a month to become a new member. Any amount you can afford, the more, the better. And if you want to do the 220, you will be joining a lot of listeners and the great Edgar B. Herrick III on September 8th on Boston Harbor. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie. And we're talking about Trump reversing, well, I don't know if reversing is fair, signing an executive order yesterday, theoretically ending the separation of families at the border. It's unclear, as we discussed with Chuck Todd, what happens after 20 days of a family held together. It is very unclear about what's going to happen. We'll talk to Gil Karlikowski about this at noon. In terms of reunification, if you're a Trump supporter, are you upset that he caved in? If you're a chronic cynic, do you think this changes nothing? Or is this a tipping point kind of moment in the Trump presidency? He clearly reversed. Well, he clearly changed his position. I think one would agree based upon colossal public pressure. I mean, that is a fact, not an opinion.
Well, I think he was starting to lose the usual troop in Congress that supports him. I mean, Orrin Hatch has been a nonstop supporter of this from Utah. Has been a nonstop supporter. He was
Ted Cruz, Mark Meadows.
Yes, exactly. Mark Meadows, the head of the Freedom Caucus, which is very, very conservative. Obviously, they were turning on him. And I think the polls were turning on him. I mean, it's hard for people to stomach the idea of little children being taken away from moms because many people, put their own children or their own nieces and nephews in that situation. It just turns their stomach.
Marlene, by the way, before I go to Marlene, just one second. And if you haven't, the story we discussed earlier, check out the story about these 239 young people that Marjorie has referenced twice going to New York City. Girls, right? I think they're girls.
I don't know.
Can you guys check that for us if the 239 are girls? I think they are, but I'm not sure whether they are or not. The mayor of New York City knew nothing about this until he heard about it on the news. Marlene, hi. My apologies for slowing you down. Hi.
Hi. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know if you had heard about on Rachel Maddow last night. She had said that a GoFundMe page has been opened up to try to find the parents of that famous young girl that in the picture that's been on all the news.
No, I didn't know that.
And they had intended to try to raise $1,500. They thought that would be what they would need to find the parents of this young girl. And it's already up to over $1.5 million.
Well, actually, Marlene, I think you're confusing two stories. I don't know about the Maddow thing. I'm sure you know what you're talking about. The thing that you're talking about, the GoFundMe thing on Facebook, there was a couple, I think, in California that decided to raise $1,500 to provide bail in the hopes that the judge would allow it for an individual or family that was detained. And in, 24 hours or something, Marjorie, they raised $8 million. And we discussed this with Ali Narani yesterday, who's an immigration expert from Washington, because neither Marjorie nor I were aware that you could get bailed in these circumstances. And I think his position was it's totally in the discretion of the judges,
right,
both whether there'll be bail, a bond offered, and what the amount will be. But we didn't know about the Maddow thing. And Marlene, we will check it out. Thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Greg from Boston, thank you for calling.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to say I am extremely lucky to be an American person.
Mm. Yeah, we all are.
I am very fortunate.
Yeah.
However, I have to say I am not very proud of our leaders at this point in our government. You know, the statement, forgetting the past and therefore repeating it, we have a history. Our white Christian culture has a history of mistreating other peoples. Think, for instance, of the Trail of Tears, Andrew Jackson's fault, the Japanese internment, attempts at extermination of Native Americans, genocidal practices. It's been going on for hundreds of years. I happen to know personally a Guatemalan man who fled twice to try to get away from the persecution he was receiving as a young man in his own country. Twice he had to attempt to get out of that situation. How can we possibly be proud to be an American today with what is going on in this country?
It's tough.
Extremely shameful.
It's tough. You know, I don't know if you saw, Greg, thanks for the call. I don't know if you saw my show last night. I had a young man, a Somali man. His name was Abdi Nor Efton.
Great.
Who won the diversity lottery, and he's written this beautiful book called Call Me American. And the most beautiful, he was very critical of President Trump, and he's from Somalia, one of the S-hole countries.
Yep.
And of course, the president and many of his colleagues in Congress want to get rid of the so-called diversity lottery. After his criticism, and when you heard him, which I know you did, Marjorie, talk about how much he loved and still loves this country above all else. It was so powerful and beautiful that I guess the message from him, Greg, I would say to us and maybe to you, is we don't have to be proud of what's happening now, but we can be proud of what we think we stand for and try to get back there. If you haven't seen that, I would suggest you Google it. He was just brilliant.
Well, you know, when Greg says we're so lucky to be Americans, I mean, we are. We could have been born in Guatemala, or we could have been born in Honduras, or we could have been in one of these situations, which I think is so. So that's why.
Well, it's our own lottery. That's why
why we don't have more compassion. You can't have everybody coming in the United States of America. We understand that, but you know, what would anybody do if your children were in danger for their lives? You'd get out of there. Anyway, let's go to Larry in Duxbury. Hi, Larry.
And I would flee also.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Larry, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that this is kind of like the village idiot became the emperor with new clothes. And we've become so desensitized to it that I wouldn't be surprised tomorrow if this is an executive order from, you know, the president that basically says they have to prove they're related or we can separate them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how bad it is.
Yeah. Well, again, let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's hope the pressure stays on. I still think the toothpaste is out of the tube here. I think it's just that there's been an exposing of not just cruelty but lying here that unless you are totally buying the Kool-Aid, you're aware of now. I mean, you can see these people in their own words saying the sky is green on Monday and then saying, whoops, it's actually blue on Tuesday. It's
what did I just say? Washington Post says 14 different times they change their story. Larry, thank you for the call. Speaking of people who defend this child separation, Amanda, one of our coworkers, just typed for us a beautiful response on Twitter to one of those people. And the person says, take a moment to be, it's sort of like what the earlier caller said, take a moment to be grateful that your own ancestors managed to find sanctuary, freedom, and opportunity in America after fleeing their own native lands, and to imagine the consequences for yourself and your family had their fates been decided by people like you. Which is pretty great.
Well, you know, Federal Judge Patty Saras has been very effective in fighting these unfair, illegal tactics by immigration. You know, talked about how they were sending this group of Christians back to a country where they would be faced death. Mm-hmm. And she was comparing it to the shipful of Jews who came here in World War II. And to our everlasting disgrace, we sent them back. And many of those people were killed in the Nazi mm-hmm. concentration camps.
So, Joe Kennedy compared it to that when he was with us the other day, after he came back from Texas.
Yeah, and he talked about a family that had fled because
still can't get over this one.
The grandmother watched her husband have his legs chopped off and then shot to death, and watched her house burn down or her child's house burn down with her grandchildren
in it.
So it's not like you're just going to get, you know, an extra 50 cents an hour.
You know what the issue for me is? How long is our attention span here? Will people delude themselves into believing that the president fixed the problem yesterday and we can go back to whatever it is we go back to after these moments when there is near unity, when people are upset with what's being done in their own name by their own government?
Okay, up next, we're going to talk to the head of customs.
No, we're not.
We're not?
I think we're going to have one more brief conversation with our listeners.
We're having one more brief conversation. I stand corrected, so stay tuned. We'll keep taking your calls.
WGBH News covers health.
I'm reporter Sarah Tan. As the Cape gears up for its first marijuana dispensary, some worry that increased access may mean increased exposure for children.
We're looking at something that was voted in by adults, but that has tremendous impact on the youth in our communities.
Listen for stories from the WGBH newsroom on 89.7 WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
If you listen to Boston Public Radio 3 hours a day, that's 15 hours a week, 60 hours a month, and 720 hours a year. Maybe it's time you pitched in. Call 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
You know, we're having this pledge drive today because we do not have commercials on WGBH or National Public Radio. If we did have commercials, we'd have these sorts of long breaks every single solitary day. I'm not going to mention, Jim, that you used to sell mail reality bills. I'm not going to mention it.
Well, then don't mention it, Marjorie.
I promise not to mention it. I'm not going to mention it.
Okay, you did.
In any case, you'd have those big breaks all the time. Because of your generosity, we don't have to have those big breaks. Mm-hmm. And many people think that a big chunk of our funding comes from the government. The vast majority of our funding comes from people like you, from private donations to WGBH. So it really matters to us. Whatever you can give, $5 per month is all it takes to become a new member. We really appreciate a little bit or a lot if you can swing it. 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
And one of the great deals, this WGBH Curiosity Cruise, September 8th from Long Wharf on Boston Harbor, Edgar B. Herrick III is leading the charge. A multimedia history lesson and a party on the water. There are only about a dozen pair of tickets left, a dozen, even though the thing is not till September. So it's your last chance to get the tickets. Really don't miss out. It is huge fun. I don't know one person I've spoken with who went who didn't love it. It's $220 if you do it now, 888, or if you want to have an opportunity, 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Yeah, you know what they really love, Jim, the thing they've been ridiculing all
Tasty
day
Bites?
Tasty Bites.
They do.
When they got off the cruise, they said, Edgar is great, Harbor Island's great, the cruise is great, but Tasty Bites?
No, they actually
are. There's the ticket.
That's not what they said. What they said was, even if Edgar was no good, doesn't really matter. Drinks, we don't care about them either. It's the TBs. Tasty Bites.
The TBs,
give
okay.
the number, please.
You want to say thank you to Walter and Dennis, Edward and Franklin, Kathleen and Scituate. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to contribute, and we hugely appreciate it. Our number, again, 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We just have a couple of minutes left in this hour. We're talking about the president signing this executive order yesterday that at least in part addresses the issue, but not in full. What your reaction is both to the policy, the consequence, and the political fallout. 877-301-8970. Noe, I hope I got that right. And Hingham, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
Very well.
Great.
Thank you for calling.
I listen to your show, guys, every day.
Thank you.
The first time I ever call, and I'm a little nervous.
Don't be.
I'm excited to talk to you guys. I guess what I'm what I'd like to say is that the point of view that we've covering right now is how Trump is exploiting the situation for political gains. But at the same time, because we're using so much of this, and obviously this is something very horrible that's happening. I'm from El Salvador. I've been here in the country for a little over 17 years. I grew up in El Salvador in one of the roughest parts there. And, I've never seen the situation change in El Salvador. In fact, I would consider El Salvador today a failed state. Three of the past presidents are either have even been indicted or about to be, and same thing is happening in Honduras, and governments in El Salvador and Central America in general, what they do is it's extremely advantageous for them to push people out of the country, the poorest people of the country, because they receive so much money from immigrants in the United States. And so, therefore, I think the conversation should not only be around, a domestic policy in the United States, but also from an international policy point of view on how we can hold this government accountable for all the human rights violations, how they're treating the people that are forcing them to take the path that they're having to take to traverse all the way from their country all the way to the horrible conditions that they find themselves into.
You know, it's funny you say that, Noe, that holding them accountable, which I think most of our listeners would agree with, but we've had callers the last few days who have taken a different tack, saying we've got to support those governments in, let's say, Central America. Maybe it's naive on their part, but you would know better. Because if there were better conditions for people there, they would feel less of a need, often out of desperation, to come to the United States. What is your reaction to that point of view?
So I guess what I can say is both. So I see it from a different perspective, both as a Salvadoran expat. And I studied sociology and a great lens, Latin American politics. So what I can tell you is that you can support in El Salvador, for example. There's no, after 1992, when the peace accords were signed, there's no right or left. There's no rightist or leftist government. There's just a bunch of thieves dressed in democracy. Nicaragua, for example, is leftist. The same thing is happening. Honduras, the same thing is happening. They're rightist. So it's a matter of we can't continue to support the political state that these countries are under at this particular moment.
Understood. Hey, Noe, we're out of time. I hope you'll call again, and we appreciate your first call. Thanks for making it.
Thank you very much. Coming up, Gil Kerkakowski, who is the head of Customs and Border Protection under President Barack Obama. He joins us next for his take on Trump's reversal. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's BPR, President Obama earned the title of Deporter-in-Chief when he was in office. But how do his practices compare and contrast with what we're seeing today? We'll look at past and present immigration policies with Gil Kerlikowski, who served as Customs and Border Protection Commissioner under Barack Obama. From there, we talked to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about Trump Care. Are the president's new health care insurance rules a death blow to the Affordable Care Act?
Then it's the return of the Smug Mug, the Curiosity Cruise, tote bags, and more. That's right, it's public radio. Pledge time. All day we're asking you to help keep us under the radar with Hallie Crossley, Heather Goldstone's Living Lab Radio, Kara Miller's Innovation Hub, and much more on the air. And, of course, it also gives us yet another opportunity to wax sardonic about Jim's infamously smug facial expression.
Thank you, Marjorie.
That, of course, is next on Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie. So as we've discussed ad nauseum today, yesterday the president uncharacteristically surrendered to public outrage and did sign an executive order to reverse, at least in part, his policy on separating families at the border. But does together necessarily mean better if these kids will now be in a different kind of detention purgatory? Joining us for his take on the immigration crisis is Gil Kerlikowski. He was the head of Customs and Border Protection under President Obama. He's now a professor at Northeastern. Gil Kerlikowski, great to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, we're thrilled to talk to you. So you know far better than we. What does the executive order the president signed yesterday actually achieve?
I think it's unclear. There's been an analysis done, I think, starting out by saying that it would really be up to Congress, that this is what the law demands, that no executive order can undo what was being done, and then to sign an executive order that actually undoes that makes a bit of a mockery of all of the discussion that has gone on from the White House in the past month on this. It does say that families will be held together, and under a current settlement, which goes back actually to Janet Reno days in the Department of Justice, the late 1990s, called the Flores Agreement, they can only be held for 20 days. And I think the administration and the Department of Justice will be looking for some relief from that 20-day period.
Now, Gil Kerlikowski, I'm sure you have never heard what I'm about to broach before. It's all Obama's fault. It was not President Trump who started this policy of separating kids from their parents or guardians at the border. It was Barack Obama. Where does the truth lie there, Gil?
Well, so the truth is that there were separations at times by Customs and Border Protection and by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And those when people were arrested and being charged. You know, some people, if you cross the border more than once and you've been charged, it becomes a felony, not the misdemeanor that it is right now for the first-time offense. If you're involved in smuggling drugs or smuggling human beings, and if you have a person, you know, you have a child with you, you're going to be prosecuted, and certainly that person cannot, you know, be held with their child. I'll tell you, those numbers were minuscule. Tiny compared to the number of people coming across the border that were actually separated.
You know, one of the things, getting back to the executive order itself and a conversation we had with Chuck Todd about an hour ago, is the whole issue of what happens to the 2,300, approximately 2,300 kids have already been separated from a parent or a guardian, whomever they came to the border with. How difficult is that task? Does our government have the ability, assuming the desire is there, to have reunification happen in all these cases?
Well, you could reunite. I mean, I think the government and Customs and Border Protection would take people out of the mix very quickly, usually within 24 hours, and turn them over to ICE. Customs and Border Protection has a pretty narrow role, and that is to apprehend people coming across the border illegally or to process people very quickly into another system if they were making a claim of credible fear or asylum. So I would think that they could be reunited, and I think it seems a little bit ridiculous that you wouldn't reunite them after signing an executive order, although I saw a strong statement saying that this group would not be grandfathered in. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
But logistically, how difficult is it? Because the numbers this time, as you point out, are not minuscule. They're quite significant. And we have stories of children being shipped all the way across the country to New York City. How hard is it?
Well, you know who the parents are and you know who the children are, and you could reunite them. I think one of the questions that will be talked about quite a bit is where are you going to have these spaces for these family units? And I think that makes a great deal of difficulty. The other part is, I mean, these kids have already now been exposed to some fairly traumatic events. But I also, of course, worry about the Border Patrol agents who were, the ones tasked with separating the children. And, I watched them deal with 68,000 unaccompanied children in the summer of 2014. And quite frankly, I could not have been more proud or more impressed with the way they handled those kids, bringing T-shirts from their own kids at home, microwaving burritos, et cetera. Well, now they've just been tasked with separating kids for the last several months. I don't know how you do that and then go home at night and look at your own kids. I get worried about them.
Well, I do wonder about that because I'm sure lots of these border agents, as you just said, have children and also have terrible feelings about what they've just done.
Yeah, there's one degree of separation on the border, and unless, people understand the border, and I spent a lot of time there both as President Obama's drug czar because of the border narcotics issues, so during the 8 years, I was there quite a bit all along the border. There is one degree of separation. There are lots of families, lots of Border Patrol agents have family in Mexico, relatives, on and on and on, and this just creates a very stressful situation for them.
We're talking to Gil Kerlikowske, who was the head of Customs and Border Protection for Barack Obama. You were a police chief years ago. Weren't you a police chief in Seattle, Gil, ages ago?
I was the police chief in Seattle for 9 years.
Okay.
Yes.
So, because I was just about to reference our own police chief here, we often have a conversation with Bill Evans when he's with us once a month about how when one cop misbehaves, either really seriously or even not quite as seriously, but it makes headlines, it trickles down onto all of his cops unfairly. When you heard this Border Patrol agent, I think it was on the ProPublica sound the other day, with this sound of the sobbing and mama and papa being cried out, say, well, we have an orchestra here. What we're missing is a conductor, which I think there was virtual, almost universal anger at the comment. What impact does a comment like that have on the men and women you were just praising with whom you worked with for years?
Well, so first, I listened to that just before I was interviewed on Judy Woodruff's NewsHour Monday night. And frankly, honestly, I did not take that anywhere near with the level of condemnation that people
really
are giving it. When you're in a stressful situation and you've got these things going on, you've also got a lot of other people that are in that room, social workers, other people, et cetera. And so, and I listened to the kind of the tone and the tenor of the way, allegedly, that Border Patrol agent said it. And I thought, maybe he is trying to, and I give him the benefit of the doubt, trying to tone down the situation and the concern. And that's the way I took it. And I would, I just didn't see agents acting that way to just make things worse or to do that. They're human beings and they're dealing with families. I don't see it that way.
I hope you're right.
We're talking to Gil Kerlikowske. He was the head of Customs and Border Protection under President Obama. You know what I wonder, Gil? since so many people that you hear about coming over the border are fleeing sort of for their lives from pretty horrible situations between gangs and corruption in the governments there, is it possible to ever really secure a border? It seems to me where there's a will, there's a way. And if people are desperate enough, they're going to find a way no matter what we do.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we, you know, that border is over 2,000 miles from rugged mountains to the San Diego urban area to the Rio Grande Valley. And that river can be, you know, 3 inches deep, or it can be a raging river depending on the time of year. So that as long as there's that desire, I think that absolutely you will never. Remember, we had 1.6 million people apprehended in the year 2000.
Oh, my God.
Fiscal year 2015 in the Obama administration, we had 315,000. I think the first year of the Trump administration, we had 310,000. To be quite frank, Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection can handle 300,000 people a year standing on their head. They've got the resources, they've got the policies, they've got the technology in place. And it can be dealt with.
You know, it must be tough in general. You just mentioned, Gil, how a lot of these Border Patrol agents may have family in Mexico and stuff. It's got to be a hard job because most of the people are not bad people. They're just desperate people.
That's absolutely the fact. I mean, you know, I sat in those holding centers, and we actually bought in McAllen a warehouse and converted it. And quite frankly, you know, no one likes that type of environment. But usually it was only meant to be there used for about 24, maybe 48 hours. So as harsh as that looks, if it's only for a very short period of time, really when people come across that border, they are dehydrated, they're exhausted, they're scared, it's very difficult. But let me go back to something else you mentioned, too, about why they're fleeing. So progressives will argue that they're fleeing gang violence and the things that can happen. But then, you know, others will say, well, look, there's also an economic incentive. It's this whole push and pull factor.
Yeah.
If you've got that opportunity for a better life, maybe better education for your children, a better chance to make a living, and you have relatives already in the United States, So it gets a little tricky to kind of characterize it as they're either fleeing gang violence or assault, or they're coming to the United States to work.
By the way, we should just report CNN has breaking news, one of my least favorite terms, but in this case it's accurate. Melania Trump is making a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border to visit a child migrant holding facility that just broke a couple of seconds ago.
You know, you were the so-called drug czar for a while, too, Gil. I wonder, as you point out, people are fleeing for economic reasons as well. I mean, my family fled for economic reasons. I think a lot of people's families came here for economic reasons. But the drug cartels, wouldn't part of the solution to their power be legalizing all drugs in the United States?
Well, you know, that was debated a lot about the legalization. And what we've seen, for instance, in Washington State and Colorado as examples of legalizing marijuana, and then this will, in fact, negate the black market. There isn't a police chief in Seattle or one in Denver that won't tell you that the black market is alive and thriving well. So the legalization issue has been discussed a lot. Prohibition, it's often likened to prohibition. But some of the best journals on prohibition, for instance, Last Call, they clearly talk about that, you know, there may be reasons to legalize drugs, but eliminating organized crime is probably not one that's going to be successful.
You know, Marjorie talks a lot about, I'm surprised she didn't allude to the experiment, for lack of a better expression, in Portugal.
Yeah.
And there's no question, according to Portuguese authorities, that it lowered the addiction rate. Did it also deal with the criminal side of the equation, or did it not? I don't know the answer.
So I traveled to Portugal because that was often seen and was discussed with me when I was the president's drug policy advisor as this kind of silver bullet. And I spent several days there in Portugal looking at it. And, you know, it's very, very difficult to take a kind of a homogenous population in a country that is much, much, much smaller, much more diverse, or much less diverse, and then say, gee, if we just take this template and try to make it work in the United States. There were multiple problems, and I met with both people, both pro and con, on that issue while I was in Portugal. But we tend to look, well, maybe we should look at Amsterdam or look at some other country. And, you know, these templates don't always fit in a country like the United States. But I would be the first to tell you that the movement toward marijuana, you know, being essentially something that you would get a traffic ticket for rather than an arrest record for small amounts of marijuana has been a smart move.
Gail, you think you might toke up after July 1st when marijuana becomes legal in Massachusetts? What do you think?
You know, I'm 68, and I never tried.
Not once.
Never tried drugs.
This could be your chance.
Never once. I never even, you know, I didn't even use the excuse like, well, I really didn't inhale.
Oh.
I think somebody said that once. That's right.
Hey, yeah, Gil. Okay.
Gil Kerlikowski.
No, I don't think at 68 I'll be. First in line at one of the stores.
Okay.
We really appreciate your time, Gil. Thanks so
much. Appreciate it. That was Gil Kerlikowski. He was the head of Customs and Border Protection under President Barack Obama. He's now a distinguished visiting fellow and professor of the practice of criminology and criminal justice at Northeastern. Thanks again, Gil, for joining us. You are listening to Boston Public Radio.
So here's the deal. I love this one, by the way. We've done this before. For $10 a month, give $10 a month to WGBH at 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. And you can get these Bluetooth earbuds, and they're really terrific. Ordinarily, by the way, they're $180. They're controlled by magnets. This is my favorite part, other than the fact they work really well. When the earbuds are separated, they power on automatically. Once they're back together with the magnets, they power off. There's built-in microphone. There's music control that work with your phone, your tablet, any Bluetooth-enabled device. So it's a great deal. They're comfortable, easy to use. They're really easy enough, even for me and Marjorie, to use. $10 a month, or if you want to do $120 all at once, but it's only at that price till 7 o'clock tonight, give us a call at 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org.
You know what else is great about these earbuds?
Nope.
When they are held together by magnets, it makes them harder to get all caught up with each other.
That
tangled.
Is an excellent
idea. Yeah, it's
very good.
Why
point.
Doesn't anybody have a good earbud container? You know what I mean?
Well, this has a great one.
Exactly.
It's got GBH on the cover,
by
the way.
It's got the container there, but when you're out and about, it's great to have the magnetic earbuds because you're not going to have them in a million knots when you try to put them on. So I want to tell you about sustaining membership really quickly. That's a monthly giving plan, and that makes it a lot easier for our people here to plan how much money they have for the coming year. And it's not so bad in your wallet is what I'm trying to say here. Because you can just give $5 a month or $10 a month. You can certainly give more if you want to, but it's not one fell swoop. It's just a little bit at a time, and that's really a great way to give for you and for us.
Did you mention we're both sustainers before we started working here? Did you say that or not? You did.
Yes, I did.
We were.
Well, I used to plan my day a lot.
I did
driving
too.
Around. If I had to go far away to report a story for the Herald when I was still there, I used to plan my day around my favorite shows on National Public Radio that I could listen to. Anyway, those were in the olden days, Jim, when there was no streaming or podcast or anything.
I got the concept. Okay.
Thanks to Carol in Newton Upper Falls, Jean in Newcastle, Valerie in Sterling. We have a podcast. Did you know that, Jim?
I do, Marjorie.
Yeah, Boston Public Radio. It's a podcast.
Okay, fine, yep.
888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
And I want to thank Elizabeth in Woburn, Diane in Burlington, George in JP, and John in Acton. This deal is pretty great, by the way. I'm not a great gadget guy, but I love these little gadgets. $120 in one shot or $10 a month. You get these terrific little Bluetooth earbuds. They work with virtually any Bluetooth-enabled device. And again, the magnet thing is great. Regardless, whether you want to do the 120, the 10, whatever you want to give, join. Be part of the thing here. It's 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're just going to take a couple of minutes before Ayanna Pressley joins us, city councilor in Boston, who is challenging incumbent Mike Capuano in the Democratic primary. Big, high-profile race, I should say. I just want to talk for a minute or two, Marjorie. I happen to say, you know, I'm sure some cynics or never-Trumpers are going to say, oh, just another scam. You know, it's an attempt to show that Donald Trump cares about this thing. I think it's, you know, you can't undo what he did. You can't make the executive order perfect when it isn't, even though you'd like Congress to. I think her visiting this detention center in Texas is a really important thing. And I also think, even though I would have liked it if when she made that statement, what, several days ago, and she said both sides have to work together, when it's clear the Democrats have not been the problem, she was criticizing her husband, just like she's criticized her husband, in my opinion, when she talks about cyberbullying, and when people ridicule her and say, boy, is she unaware. She doesn't even realize the cyberbullier in chief is in the, I was going to say, same bed, whatever, the same house as she is. I think she has taken him on. And I think going there, whether it's to help her husband's from a PR perspective or not, is a really good thing for these kids, these families, and for this country.
Well, you know what? I mean, she's much more popular with the American public than he is, and for good reason. I mean, she did that Be Best campaign. It did seem kind of, well, it did seem rather crazy in light of what her husband just did, but I think she's sincere. I think she's a devoted mother to their son, Barron, and she's obviously extremely attached to him, and they've kept him out of the limelight, as presidents do. And, you know, I read a profile for a long time ago in the New York Times when she first became First Lady. She's worked really hard her whole life. I'm not sure she made the best choice for marriage.
Well, that's for another day. Can we dip into this for about just a few seconds? I have no idea what she's talking about, but she's at the detention center.
Basis. And I also like to ask you how I can help to these children to reunite with their families as quickly as possible. So thank you again for all what you do, and thank you as well. Thank you all for what you do.
Well, we missed the first minute. I think she only spoke for about 60 or 90 seconds.
Yeah.
We missed most of it. But it's interesting that when we did dip into it, the one thing she was mentioning is the thing we spoke to Gil Kerlikowske about, the thing we spoke to Meet the Press's Chuck Todd about this morning, is reunification. You know what was interesting? Obviously, Gil's the expert. He ran Border Patrol, Border and Customs. Chuck Todd knows his stuff, even if he doesn't have expertise there. Kerlikowske is totally convinced that we have the information and the ability to reunite all these families if we choose. And Chuck Todd, I think, is in the majority, maybe less schooled majority than Kerlikowske, who thinks this isn't as easy a feat.
Well,
I have to say, even if you listen to the Health and Human Services officials who worked for the president last night, there was total contradiction about whether or not they, because the order does not mandate the reunification, doesn't grandparent in the kids who have already been separated, even though they've said they want to reunite them. I was really made hopeful because I never spoke to Kerlikowske before. He doesn't sound like a hyperbolic kind of guy. He's a pretty just the facts, ma'am, kind of guy. And he seemed quite positive about their ability to do it should they choose to.
Obviously, I hope he's right. The only difference is he said that the numbers of families that were separated under his administration were tiny numbers.
Minuscule, right.
And they were like drug smugglers and stuff like that. And when you're talking about thousands, everyone keeps talking about the confusion. So obviously,
he said we know who the kids are. We know who the parents are. And again, he didn't sound flip about it.
No, I hope he's right.
I hope he's – well, I also hope not only that he's right – that the desire is there. One of our coworkers, one of our producers, made a very good point. We can't even keep track of kids in our own foster system in our own state. So there's no question on the margins there's going to be some issues. But also, when you send all these kids to New York, that's where it seems that you made the point. That's where it seems to me to be much more difficult. The further away geographically
they get from their families. The kid is,
yeah.
Too. I mean, remember all these kids that were a little bit older that were memorizing the phone numbers of their aunt or memorizing
the phone. Was that a painful story?
Yes, and they had pictures of the family and stuff like that. Obviously, if you're 18 months or 2 years old, that's going to be a lot harder for you to do. But let's absolutely hope he's right. And good for Melania Trump. I'm glad she's going to Texas, and I'm glad she's gone to this child care center. The detention center, rather, and I'm glad she's made the effort to do that.
And you know, while we're praising Melania Trump, I just have to say, if you have not heard what I consider to be the most disingenuous of tweets from the daughter congratulating her father, POTUS, as she calls him, President of the United States, for basically ignoring the fact that he created the problem that then he allegedly fixed or is in part fixing.
Her
just
tone deafness from the picture she that got Samantha Bee in such trouble, the picture she posted of her little boy face to face, and the picture she posted on Father's Day while all this is going on.
Exactly.
There she is with her husband and all her kids. I mean, the woman is completely and utterly
This is Ivanka
deaf.
Trump we're talking about, not Melania,
Ivanka
just so that
Trump.
People are clear. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, up next we're going to talk to Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. She's running for Congress. We're going to find out what her campaign is all about. Ayanna Pressley next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The historic wave of women running for Congress and governor this year has already landed 78 women on November ballots in several states. Here with us in Studio 3 is someone who could be among them, Ayanna Pressley. Ayanna, as you know, is running against Congressman Michael Capuano in the Democratic primary to represent the 7th District. She's a Boston City Councilor at large and a frequent top vote getter. Councilor, it's great to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for coming. And you got to, the earrings don't work with the headphones.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The droopy ones. So Councilor, tell people that why you are running for Congress.
Yeah, I'm running because the 7th Congressional District is the most diverse district in our delegation, and yet it is the most unequal. And if you need any evidence of that, if you just get on the number one bus in Cambridge in Harvard Square and ride that to Dudley Square in Roxbury, visually you will see a stark contrast of life walks, of life outcomes, quite literally median household income and life expectancy drop by decades. It's why I've just rolled out doing one plank at a time, an equity agenda to address these disparate outcomes throughout the district. And these conditions, this economic inequality, the wealth and wage gap, structural racism, gun violence, they were all created. These conditions were created by policy. And so the way to disrupt this and to improve the outcome and the legacy of this district is to legislate. And so leadership has to be about much more than years served. It has to be about much more than votes cast. To be frank, this is the most progressive district in the country, a seat held by JFK. So to have a progressive voting record is not necessarily a profile in courage. That's just baseline to keep your job. So this is about, and these times require, leadership and leaders that will vote the right way, that will lead, that will be intentional about legislating. The Globe just put out a piece, I think 6 days ago, about how we are losing our standing in the country for leading and innovating and ushering in new frontiers when it comes to policymaking. And then finally, I would just say that the district has changed. The needs of the district have changed. And so far as I'm concerned, so has the job description. And it requires an activist leadership. And look at the demographics. The district is now, 57% people of color, 30% foreign-born residents, and almost 40% single female-headed households. So, you know, I think these times require a different brand of leadership, and it's a way that I've already governed.
You've used the term leadership a couple of times. I assume, well, I shouldn't assume anything. You can speak for yourself. Is Mike Capuano not a leader, even though you mentioned he has a progressive voting record? Is he not a leader?
Well, I'm not saying that. I respect the congressman and his service and his contributions. What I'm simply saying is that I bring a different brand of leadership, which I think is in keeping with what these times require. Leaders that are conveners, leaders that build movements, leaders that build coalitions. That's what these times require.
You know, I don't know who we were talking to last week, Ayanna Pressley, but a statistic was put in front of us, and I hope I got this right. I know I'm close to right anyway. The first half, I know I'm right, that there's been no more reliable voting block for Democrats in this country, whether it's Doug Jones in Alabama or Hillary Clinton running for president, than African-American women. Yet there's somewhere, this is a number that I might get slightly off, but not by much. I think there are 43 African-American women running for Congress. And as of last week, only one of them had received the endorsement of any nationwide Democratic organization, meaning 42 out of 43 had not. What does that say to you about the Democratic Party's commitment to the people who have been the most committed to them?
Well, I'll just say that we are at a crossroads, not only in our country, and not only is the 7th Congressional District at a crossroads, but our democracy is. And I do think this is a moment in time where we have to dig deep and ask ourselves, are we who we say we are? Or do we simply espouse values that we put on bumper stickers, but that we don't put in the sweat equity and we're not committed to actualizing? I mean, certainly a more inclusive and representative government matters. Representation does matter. That is not the motivation behind my run. It's one of the things that has graded me throughout this candidacy, this banding about of identity politic. I am a Black woman. I embrace both of those parts of my identity, but I'm a leader and a problem solver, and that's what this district needs.
But why does that grade on you? That is part. I mean, isn't because that part of your deal? I don't
because
mean
that isn't
critically at all.
Let me give you an example. Yeah. It is not the totality of my identity, and no one can project onto me how I define me. And that is not the impetus for my run. Representation matters, but that's not why I'm running. I'm running because I'm proven at addressing some of our most systemic, challenging, complex social issues through nuanced, comprehensive policymaking and doing that in partnership with community, which is what people want and deserve. They want to be a co-pilot in the governing, in the visioning, in the development of their community. What they want and what they deserve are leaders that will restore their hope and extend a hand of partnership. So what bothers me is when I say there are individuals who feel overlooked and communities that feel silenced, people immediately assume in default I'm only talking about people of color, and I'm not. I'm talking about the artist in Somerville who's afraid of being displaced, the entrepreneur in Roxbury that needs access to capital, the electrician in Everett who sees his or her union rights being dismantled, the grandmother in Chinatown who wakes up every day worried if Chinatown will still be Chinatown, the researcher in Cambridge who worries they'll lose their job because we have an administration that doesn't believe in science. So defeating all of that is about more than a vote, because a vote on the floor of Congress doesn't defeat the draconian, bigoted, cruel, short-sighted policies coming out of that White House. Only a movement can do that. And by the way, for those who think this candidacy is so disruptive and unconventional, I'm simply meeting head-on the challenge that our party gave us in 2016, which is to ignite and to expand the electorate. And this candidacy is doing that, and we see that up close and personal every day.
We're talking to Ayanna Pressley, city councilor in Boston, who's running against Mike Capuano for the Democratic nomination in the 7th CD.
So, Councilor, what do you say to people that like what you're saying, don't like the fact that we have a delegation that's almost all men and everybody's white, like the idea of a disruptor, like what you've done in the city council, and yet they're saying if the Democrats get the House in 2018, Mike Capuano is going to be an incredibly powerful guy. He's in terms of housing and in terms of transportation. You're just going to be a new person on the block. He can bring home the bacon in a way that you can't.
Well, Washington, D.C. has changed. There are no earmarks. There's not bringing home the bacon.
Well, that's not true. Well, I think most people would agree the $1 billion in federal money for the Green Line extension.
Hold on.
Let me finish a sentence. Okay. That were it not for Capuano's, I won't even use the word leadership, advocacy, that that Green Line might not be built. So that may not be what you consider to be an earmark, but that is something that Capuano deserves some credit for, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. What I'm saying is that are we advocating for and fighting for the investments that will change the legacy and the outcomes of this district from being the most diverse and yet the most unequal? One of the things that I would love to establish is a transit equity caucus. I want us to also reframe and rethink about infrastructure and what that means. Infrastructure is not about more highways and more underpasses. It's about an investment in multimodal transit. It's about the acknowledgement that with a population growth and moving towards greater density in our development, we've got to invest in our crumbling sidewalks. This isn't just about bridges. It's about multimodal transit, and that is going to be critical, especially moving towards the future. Now, to answer your question, I hope that we are in the Democratic majority And I would love to play a part in ushering in that blue wave. I have dedicated my life to this party and democracy. I have been a faithful foot soldier, dispatched and deployed to elect Democrats in this Commonwealth and throughout the country as a city councilor. So I care about that. But if we're in the majority, what matters is not only that we're in the majority, but who are the Democrats in the majority? And if we're not in the majority, and we continue in the minority, do we abdicate our responsibility to lead? Do we just vote no like a robot and go home? We've got to keep building these movements and coalitions, and we've got to intentionally legislate. Ted Kennedy dedicated his life to fighting for universal health care. He didn't see it realize in his lifetime, but they didn't restrain him from still putting forward the legislation. I want to legislate. I want to cooperatively govern.
You know, Councillor, you earlier when I asked you, you're saying that Mike Capuano is not a leader. You say, I'm not saying that. I have respect for Capuano.
Absolutely.
In the last sentence, you said, are we just going to abdicate our responsibility to lead? Are we just going to vote no and then go home? I mean, you are talking about Mike Capuano.
Oh, no. I'm challenging all of us to do more and to dig deeper because that's what the times require.
What is he not
doing?
This is bigger. What is he not doing in your estimation? Let's assume for argument's sake, first of all, if you're elected, do you vote for Nancy Pelosi?
I mean, I think that's a premature conversation.
Why?
Because I don't know who else will be. I think the Democrats have to have a party, have to have a discussion about the future of this party and what that leadership looks like.
But why should voters not know?
That's not a single, you know, that's a broader discussion. I don't know who else will be stepping forward. I respect, Leader Pelosi for the role that she played in the ACA. And I think that's a conversation for another day. What I care about right now is doing everything possible to get Democrats in the majority.
But you're not guaranteeing that you would vote for her. Is that a fair statement?
It's a premature discussion.
Okay, so let's talk about a number that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago. And I think for those of us who read the 7-part series in the Boston Spotlight series, the one thing, and I wish we had all taken more away from it, but the one thing imprinted on our brains was that number that some of us have seen before, that the average assets, wealth, of a white family in Boston is somewhere in the $250,000 range, and the average asset of a black family in Boston is $8. And almost everybody I spoke to said, is that a typo? It's not a typo. What do you do about it? Everybody I know deplores it. What does a congressperson from the 7th CD do to try to fix that grotesque inequality?
Sure. Well, again, these conditions were created by policymaking. Because African Americans didn't have the same access to the GI Bill, generationally over time, that has contributed to an outcome of two generational poverty and, in many instances, two generational trauma, which, again, I want to disrupt. We have a segregated housing and school system because of redlining. A lot of the violence that we see is a byproduct of these social determinants. So, yes, we are, you know, all Democrats are committed to a living wage, and that's important. But I'll tell you one way I'm getting at this. Right now, I'm working to convene an asset management conference, and I am defining asset as restaurant owners, bodega owners, beauty salon owners, barbershop owners, child care providers in home and in community. Why? Because these are the informal economies that have emerged in low-income immigrant and communities of color, most of which are owned by immigrants, women, and people of color. They have been the path of least resistance to wealth building, entrepreneurialism, and they have destabilized workforces. Now, most elected officials only go to those businesses to put a sign in their window, but they represent 30% to 40% of our main streets. So while we are focused on how to incentivize new markets and to diversify goods within community, we have to also be extending a hand of partnership and resource to these informal economies. And I think in doing so, if we're really serious about economic inequality, the wealth and wage gap, to support these businesses and to listen to what are their greatest challenges and what are those barriers will go a long way. These are jobs that they hire locally. Again, the path of least resistance to business ownership, but they have destabilized workforces. You only get paid when you work, low wages, no benefits, businesses that are very hard on the body. So how do we support them? And again, what I'm doing by actively listening, by remaining in close proximity to those that are most impacted by an issue, I know that's where the solutions are. Jim, Marjorie, every issue that I've had a legislative victory on is because I extended a hand and created a table for those most impacted, and I knew the solutions existed there. It's my job as a leader to lift up stories and struggle, but also to harness the innovation and the ideas. The people closest to the pain should be the closest to the power, driving and informing the policy making. You know, I worked for all those years to reform the state's liquor license laws. Why did I know that was a real thing? Because I paid attention, and then I met with everyone who stood to be impacted and said, how do we address this disparity?
Tell people about the disparity, because I think a lot of people don't know about that, the liquor licenses in Boston.
Sure. So it's not that dissimilar from the taxi medallions, truthfully. And I've been doing the same work to ensure and to codify equity in the emerging cannabis industry so that we're not 100 years later trying to reverse that hurt. But I worked for some 4 years with the city council, two mayors, and our state legislature to reform the state's liquor license laws, which were incredibly antiquated, 100 years old, a racist law. They didn't trust the Irish to determine where licenses should be purchased and distributed. And so over time, that created a two-tiered food system. And so you had neighborhoods like the North End, the South End, the Back Bay that were cobbled together with these important walkable amenities in the form of sit-down restaurants, critical social and economic anchors. And the neighborhoods like Hyde Park, Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester that didn't know a new sit-down restaurant for 10, 15, 20 years. Because no matter how good your food is, and I like to eat, I didn't just get these hips from my mother, your profit margin is made on your bar. And so it was cost prohibitive. The licenses were going for $250,000 for full alcohol, for beer and wine, $35,000 to $55,000. And so we reformed those laws. But the point is, I brought everyone together. And I knew this was a real issue, not just anecdotally because of what I observed. Jim, I want to get back to your question. You said, so what's the difference between me and Mike, basically? And what's inferred in that is, other than racism.
Did I say that?
Well, earlier you did ask that. You know, so, and maybe what's inferred in that is, other than, you know, race and gender, you'll likely vote the same way. Let me just say this. I don't define leadership simply by how one votes. You really can't do that in Massachusetts because most Democrats will vote the same way. Look at the 3rd Congressional District. Nikki Tsongas has retired. I don't know. Someone drops out every day. Maybe there's 12 people running for that seat right now. And all those Democrats will vote the same. When Seth Moulton challenged John Tierney, no one said there's nothing to say to see here, you know, because they're going to vote the same. If this were an open seat.
Well, but in all fairness, Tierney had some serious problems in his family and potential criminal problems, which Mike Capuano does not have. So it was a different kind of challenge than yours. Is that not a fair statement?
Let me just say this. This is the seat held by JFK. This is a seat that not only creates an opportunity to be unrestrained and unencumbered and to be a leader in this delegation for the most diverse and unequal district in the whole delegation, but arguably the most progressive district in the country. That means we can be bold. That means we can be innovative. That means we can legislate. But let me tell you the difference. After the Marjorie Stone, this is about worldview. We just see things differently. The electorate will decide if it's better or if it's what they want, but I'm just saying it's different. It's not an indictment on my opponent. It's different. After the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Parkland, Florida, that tragic, horrific shooting. And just to be clear, this is an issue that I've dedicated my life to, gun violence, not just my council tenure. It is a public health crisis and epidemic, and I want to go to Congress to make sure we treat it as such. There is no hierarchy of hurt. Whether we are being robbed of a life on a city block, gang-affiliated or not, or whether through to domestic terrorism we are being robbed of lives at a church, at a school, or at a concert, it is all tragic. But after that shooting, my opponent authored an op-ed for the Bay State Banner about Parkland. Now, this district, Chelsea, has 4 times the rate of violence of the Commonwealth. We know what happens in Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester, what's now going to East Boston and Charlestown and Roslindale. We were both interviewed and asked, what should we do to ensure student and school safety? My opponent said, when he was the mayor of Somerville and they had problems at the high school, they brought in police, and that might be the way to go, to bring in more school police. Now, I just vigorously disagree. It's cliche, but no less true. Hurt people hurt people. In Chicago, they've gotten rid of their school police, and we know they had all these school police, and the violence wasn't stopping. They've gotten rid of school police, invested in social workers, and that's what I've been fighting for, trauma-sensitive and informed schools. And furthermore, the militarization of our schools will result in the disproportionate enforcement on Black and brown students contributing to the school-to-prison pipeline. We need nurses, guidance counselors, social workers, trauma-sensitive and informed schools, not the militarization of our schools.
Ayanna Pressley, I think this is a fair statement, because the other ones I've made, you haven't agreed with, but this one I think you would. Boldness is one of the things that you are talking about. You think we need more boldness. The district you want to represent has several, I mean, half of Somerville, I think it's half of, well, half of Cambridge, some percentage of Somerville, obviously Boston. If the leadership is not bold enough in Congress to undo things like that $250,000 to $8 differential, is the leadership bold enough in City Hall? Would we be better off not only having you representing the 7th CD, but an Ayanna Pressley-like candidate being the mayor of the city of Boston?
Jim, I'm simply saying the value add that I believe I bring and that I've proven in my 8 years on the Boston City Council. I respect tremendously my colleagues in government. We all have a different worldview and we all have a different governing approach.
No, I'm not saying you disrespect him, but you said you respect Mike Capone a lot, and I believe you when you say it, but you think you'd be a better office holder. I believe you respect Mayor Walsh, too. I'm saying, would we be better off in Boston with a bolder mayor? Because obviously, if Capuano is in part responsible for some of the problems you're talking about, I assume Marty Walsh is too, no?
But Jim, let me say this. We're all responsible. This is not about any one person. This is about the need for us to bring greater emphasis and spotlight to certain issues. And my worldview is just different. The issue of maternal mortality, that's an issue that I've been looking into for the last 6 months, and we know the sharp contrast of that. The Congressional Black Caucus, Robin Kelly out of Illinois, introduced the Mamas Act to specifically address the issue of maternal mortality. So far, no one in the delegation has signed on to that legislation. Do I think that's out of malice? And because they don't care? Of course not. It's just about a lack of perspective to see that as an issue that we need to be leading on.
So when we invite you and Mike Capuano to either debate on the radio or on television with me, you'll say yes, correct?
Of course.
Well, we have to get Ayanna Pressley back here because I didn't have the chance to ask my most important question.
What is it?
Well, not everybody's into it, but I'm very concerned about tree equity.
Do you follow me on Twitter? I'm kind of a dope on Twitter, but I know you're big into tree equity.
This is a big deal. Explain it to people.
It is a big issue.
You have 45 seconds.
Okay, so really quickly again, this is the most diverse district and the most unequal, and that is also true when it comes to building up the resiliency of community to mitigate climate. And so as if you look at cities like Chelsea, if you look at neighborhoods like East Boston, they do not have the same density of tree canopy, which is about
Marjorie's.
It's a big deal.
It's true.
It is a big
it's
deal.
It's true. And it's about public health, and it's about quality of life, and it's about property value. But again, it is also about climate resilience and mitigation. And it also promotes walkability because you have shade, right? So again, multimodal transit and what enhances that. And so I'm challenging all of us to be more committed to making sure that the trees that we are planting are staying alive, that we are more aggressive in our planting, and that we move with a greater urgency around growing our tree canopies and protecting our mature trees because they really play
and
a critical
troubled
role
times,
in this.
Who doesn't want to look at a leafy tree at this time
But
of
I'm just
year?
Trying to say, you know, these issues and how we get at these inequities are both in the macro and the micro.
What's your website?
www.ayannapressley.com. And my headquarters grand opening is this Saturday in Jamaica Plain. 10 a.m. Okay, so follow me on all my social media platforms. We would love to see you there.
Okay,
great.
I'll just start following on Twitter because I'm into the trees.
Thank
Ayanna Pressley,
you.
Thank you very
Thanks
much for
so
coming
much for
in.
Your time. We really
Ayanna
appreciate
Pressley
it.
Is running in the Democratic primaries to represent the 7th Congressional District. She is a Boston City Councilor at large. To learn more about her campaign, go to ayannapressley.com. Ayanna Pressley, thank you again for coming in. Up
thank
next,
you.
If our justice system believes people are innocent until proven guilty, should our medical system believe people are alive until they're proven dead? Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for his take on emergency responders. Catastrophic move in declaring code blue too soon. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. While the Trump administration's practice of dividing families at the border has also divided the nation, it is bringing one community together, the medical one, where there's a clear consensus that taking infants and children away from their parents is traumatic to the degree that it causes mental and physical stress. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan has been leading a petition drive from ethicists to keep families together. Art's the doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Art Kaplan. Well, before we get to the petition, tell us why there's such great concern for these children being held in continued detention?
Well, you know, it's a huge ethics issue. We tend to look and see what's the harm and is there harm to the kids. And as Jim just said, you know, there's consensus among the pediatricians and the psychologists and the mental health people that being torn away from your family and not knowing what's going on is stressful, inimical to your development, bad for the kids. So we know the consequences of breaking up families out of the blue and then kids not knowing where their parents are, parents not knowing where their kids are, that's not good for you. But it's also a moral issue in that busting up families is inherently wrong. What Trump tried to do was to use kids as a pawn in a game to get certain things that he wants done in the immigration world. He basically said, well, I'm going to break up these families and I'm going to put the screws on these kids. And until you say uncle, I'm going to keep doing it until you build me my wall and pass other legislation that he favors. Using kids as pawns in a political debate, you know, saying I'm going to hurt them until you guys scream and do what I want, which, again, is what I think Trump was doing and continues to do, by the way, we can come back to that, is inherently unethical. Kids are vulnerable. They can't take care of themselves. We're supposed to protect them. We're supposed to watch out for them. All the human rights documents that we've signed said, you know, we will do that. By the way, whether it's the Catholic Church abusing kids or other instances of people abusing children in their care, I think this is just on a par with that. I think it's child abuse.
You know, Art, the morality, I'm hoping everybody listening to the show agrees with, but most of us understood as this began that obviously there's psychological damage, and we assumed, despite lacking medical training, that that damage was long term, even if there was a reunification at some point. There's also clear evidence that there is physical damage done to these kids that's long lasting as well, correct?
Correct. So it comes in two ways. There's abuse. We've already got reports coming out of sexual abuse. We've already got reports coming out that people are giving powerful drugs to the kids to calm them down and restraining them. And then we know that this kind of trauma affects your growth, affects your physical well-being. We know it's true. We know what it is to be made an orphan unwillingly, so to speak, you know, to have that terrible thing happen to you. And by the way, in terms of the burden on this burden of doing these things, let's call it for what it is. It isn't just Trump who's responsible. The cabinet was out there going it for this policy. There are definitely authorities, government authorities, private security involved in busting up families and moving infants, by the way, and children away from their families. There's a whole chain of complicity here. And let me give you a parallel. If we had a child abuse ring that we discovered somewhere and the leader of it announced, oh, well, I'm going to stop doing that, we would still hold them culpable, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's great that Trump announced that the policy that he put in, he's going to stop because it was causing too much political damage to him. He calculated wrong. But where's the accountability?
Well, that's one of the things we'll find out, whether this has a longer shelf life than the John McCain attack and the Kizer Khan attack. You know, one thing before we talk about what your petition actually says, I don't know if this is an ethical issue. Do you think it's unethical for the Secretary of Homeland Security to go to a Mexican restaurant after she maybe we should move on from that. So what is this petition that drive that you're leading say and attempt to do there, Art Kaplan?
So the petition basically says, look, we leave it to the doctors and the psychologists to tell us about the harms, and that makes isolating kids and busting up families wrong, the consequences. But we also think morally, you can't use kids as pawns. You can't sort of sacrifice them to political ends. You can't violate internationally recognized agreements, including by us, that say children have rights, and fundamental to that is trying to make sure they can be with their families and that their physical and mental welfare is protected. There's a moral case. It's even deeper in some ways than the obvious problem of causing harm, and the ethicists, I thought, ought to speak out. So I organized the petition. We got about 300 people in the U.S. To sign up who are leading moral thinkers, religious thinkers, bioethicists, people who just do moral philosophy. And it spread like wildfire. People get the immorality of what was going on. And I have to say, it wasn't just the usual suspect, you know, lefty pinko professor crowd. We had plenty of conservatives who said, this is wrong. You can't do this to kids.
Has anybody refused to sign it who you've approached?
Out of asking maybe 300, one.
And do you know what the, feel free to name him or her, but if you choose not to, you know what the reason for the no was?
They didn't say. They didn't say. They just said, I'm not comfortable doing it. Now, sometimes if you work at a public institution, people get nervous about signing petitions with political import. Okay. And so that may be, it may not be the issue. It may be the, I don't want to make myself vulnerable.
Art, well, we wish you luck, needless to say. So beyond Marjorie's head ready to pop off over this whole separation of kids thing, a close second in terms of the head popping off thing for Marjorie are the new health plans offered by the Trump administration. Could you describe what they do and what they don't do?
So the Trump administration remains steadfast in its desire to roll back, get rid of, blow up Obamacare. And it's already said, look, you don't have to worry about making people pay more for their health insurance if you want to get the sick to pay more or those with pre-existing conditions, which, by the way, include things like pregnancy. I guess I would have one now with my knee surgery, pre-existing. So you don't have to worry. You can charge them more. You can charge the elderly more because they consume more health care, so we're not going to group men all together. The new plans, I'm going to put it succinctly. Basically, Trump is saying you can sell garbage insurance. If it's cheaper, go ahead and sell it. The Obamacare plan basically said you got to cover certain things. You have to include them in the benefits package, things like, again, pregnancy care or mental health benefits. Trump's bright idea for achieving cost containment is to say, no, you don't. You can sell whatever you want. Let people buy a plan that has a $5,000 deductible and doesn't cover anything except putting your head back on if it pops off, and that's great.
So the hope, again, there is that he'll be able to claim it's wonderful, which he has, and hope people believe him, and then they will just be in left field if something if it happens to them.
It's so obvious that if you buy one of these, there's a name for them. I've forgotten it. Either of you remember?
Association. Yeah.
Well, junk is good, but yeah, associated plans or something.
Yeah.
You just know that somebody's going to buy one of these things, wind up with a kid who is depressed and suicidal and try to get them mental health care, and they're going to be told not covered, or somebody's going to say, I want to get my birth control pills, not covered, or somebody's going to say, gee,
prescription drugs.
You had a need for prescription drugs,
right,
and you got to get them. Nope, not covered. Or even things like, you were in a horrible accident and you need a lot of care, but your copay is huge. I mean, it's back to the old days. I would guess between the you can underwrite people out, meaning charge them a lot for pre-existing or age, and buy a crappy, lousy plan, I think we're going back to the 20% uninsured days. So, you know, maybe Trump thinks that's wonderful. I don't.
Well, the other thing is, and just to straighten me out on this, we had somebody call the other day and said she didn't have to worry about this because she had insurance through her employer. But if you lose your job or you're laid off, and as you say, you have a pre-existing condition, whether it's high cholesterol or high blood pressure or diabetes or anything, that leaves you, if they get rid of this pre-existing condition deal, that leaves you out in left field yet again.
Correct. And your small employer may say, yep, I will pick you up for the next job, but we only sell the lousy plan.
Yeah. Okay.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. Speaking of healthcare plans, about a year ago, Marjorie and I were at a highbrow, very high-end event we were invited
to.
Yeah, we were. And
did
Marjorie,
you come to my house?
No, actually, Marjorie was off tipping martinis or whatever it is she was doing. And I was talking to this.
You were wolfing down lobster claws.
Maybe I was.
As I
so I'm talking to this guy who's really smart. And we talk and we're talking and we're talking. And at some point I say something like, you know, you really know a lot about healthcare stuff. I said, I'm Jim Browdy. He says, oh, I'm Atul Gawande. And I go, oh, my God.
Not so to mention that we interviewed him.
We had had him on the radio show.
We had his book come out. We interviewed him
so
extensively.
It was a multiple.
And then you said, what, have another lobster claw?
Yeah.
It was humiliating. In any case, I don't know how excited. I am pretty excited. This J.P. Morgan, people know Diamond and Warren Buffett, obviously a very wealthy guy. Jeff Bezos, by far the wealthiest person, I think, on the planet now, have come together to form something. It is unnamed. I'm not clear what it's going to do. And they have picked, I think most people think, one of the most creative, innovative thinkers in healthcare, Atul Gawande, to run it. It's going to come to, it's going to be headquartered in Boston. He starts in the job on July 9th. What, based on the little bit that we know, but with a lot of money behind it, are you? What do you think they're going to do? Are you hopeful? What's your reaction to this?
Well, if you take basically one of our smartest thinkers in healthcare, Atul Gawande is a surgeon. For those who read highbrow magazines and hang out with Marjorie and Jim at fancy parties, he writes in the New Yorker a lot, so you can sort of see what some of his thoughts are there. He's run a program that I know about that he and I have talked about, trying to deliver cheaper surgical services to poor people in India to see if you could kind of, you know, lower the cost and let them benefit from care that they otherwise wouldn't get. So basically the companies are saying, we want you to have, let's call it an entity that you experiment with, deliver cheaper costs of healthcare to us, and we'll give you basically a million lives between all the companies and things that we own and a lot of money, and you figure out ways to try and get good coverage and drive costs down. So I like it. I mean, you know, that's a nice investment. I'm not the world's – look, here, you want two criticisms. One, I don't think Atul has run a big company per se. You know, he's not really like Don Berwick or one of the health policy maestros in the state of Massachusetts. So I guess people may say, well, I don't know, is that the right guy to be a CEO type? I mean, my own view is yes, we need creative thinking, not the usual MBA stuff. So I'm on board. And then the other potential criticism is it's still market-driven, trying to play around with the idea that you can make healthcare efficient. It takes away from things like, well, why don't we just go to single-payer, one of our dreamy, starry-eyed Bernie Sanders-type solutions. I like single-payer, but politically we're not going there, right? I mean, we could barely stop Trump from rolling back Obamacare, so I don't think single-payer is on the horizon, so let's see what this can do. So,
by the way,
you know,
since you mentioned Berwick, who's been with us quite a few times, and I assume most people know, ran for governor a few years ago, ran Medicare and Medicaid for Barack Obama. Here's what his reaction was to it in the Globe. He rejected the idea that it's just going to be a well-funded think tank. I like this line. I think it's going to be a do tank, he said. It's an activist move by organizations that really do want to make a change. They picked a leader in Atul Gawande who is almost uniquely capable of crafting the changes that are going to be needed. So at least Berwick, who really is, I think we'd all agree, is sort of at the top of that pyramid,
you know what, you
is pretty
know,
optimistic.
You know what I really like about Atul Gawande, surgeon, Harvard Medical School professor, New Yorker, big deal guy, that in his book he admitted a lot of the things he did wrong.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, counseling patients in late stage of life and stuff.
Yep.
He had a humility that you don't often see in that.
Yeah, that's that. He's written some about trying to manage end-of-life care.
Yes.
And dying people and said, I didn't do this right.
Yes.
And I wouldn't do it the same way. And that's great. You know, you don't. You're right, Marjorie. You don't see it. I mean, you certainly don't hear it from me, but
Okay. So we're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. We're going to keep talking to him after a quick break. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
If you listen to Boston Public Radio 3 hours a day, that's 15 hours a week, 60 hours a month, and 720 hours a year. Maybe it's time you pitched in. Call 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
That's right. 15 hours a week, Jim. Many hours in a year. That's a lot of hours.
A lot of hours on the radio.
We're appealing to your guilt there. I'm appealing to your guilt, too, because you know why? We really want to beat our other colleagues here
at
WGBH.
That's unhealthy.
Yes, we do, and the show's over in 45 minutes. So if you want to do the right thing, it'd be great if you could give right now to 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. Jim and I get a gold star.
You're so petty. No, we don't.
I am petty. I do want to win. I'm competitive. I want to
win.
I want to win. So here's the deal.
I'm sick of winning. How about you?
I can never win enough.
Go ahead.
I can never win enough. Anyway, you can support us at $10 a month. If you do, we'll thank you with these really neat little Bluetooth earbuds we have. They're magnetic, and they won't tangle. That's because when you take them off, they zip right back together again, so you don't have those terrible tangles.
By the way, the best part is the sound. I know you like the magnet, but the sound is really high quality.
But it's important not to have them tied in knots in your car. So like I said, when the earbuds are separated, they power on, and once back together, they power off, and they stick together, and there's a built-in microphone and music controls. The number again is 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. We have now 42 minutes left in the show. Is it 42 minutes left in the show?
42 minutes, yeah.
42 minutes left in the show. So, you know, do what you can do.
Okay, I'll get on board with you. I mean, it's fine. You can give any time. But it matters most, obviously, to Marjorie because she's selfish that you give during our show. So let's make a big push. If you're contemplating giving today, and you should, get it over with. It is the worst to be wait. Just do it today. Do it now. 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. Take it 2 minutes. It'll be over with. Thanks to Rich in Newport, Rhode Island, who was already done what I just urged people to do. Ellen in Holliston, Sally in Wellesley, Lisa in North Andover. Mm-hmm. Again, Marjorie doesn't care about any of our coworkers or any of the other shows, obviously. But, I mean, you're honest. Yeah. I admire that.
No, I would like to point out that I'm so selfish. I paid for your parking tip yesterday at $10.
You did.
Today I paid for your egg white wrap.
I got two for one. In any case, 888-897.
Egg white wrap.
888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org. And by the way, if you're not interested in the earbuds or you don't care, you don't want to do $120, do whatever you can. As little as $5 a month is all it takes to get you to become a new member. Who would, if you care about the station, care about what we all do here, why wouldn't you want to be a part of this operation? So do it now. Don't wait. Procrastinators wait too long and feel bad. Just do it now and get it done.
Not that I'm obsessing over it. I also paid for the bagels. Just want to point
that
out.
No, you actually did pay for the bagels.
And the egg white wrap.
Okay, fine.
Okay,
what's
so
the number?
So the number is 888-897-9424, WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're in the middle of a conversation with medical ethicist Art Kaplan.
So, Art Kaplan, everybody's going to assume that they are being watched 24/7. That's all I could say. Either it's somebody's cell camera or somebody's video or whatever.
Mm.
Tell us about this emergency room
funny,
doctor.
Marjorie.
Well, it's not funny, but it's just incredible. This emergency room doctor in this Northern California hospital.
You mean our friend who
are you dead, sir?
Is this the one who said, stop mouthing off to me. Unless you're dead, I don't want to hear from you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what to draw as a moral lesson other than you shouldn't sort of tell people off in that way. That's bedside manner, as they say. Docs get irritated. Sometimes nurses do, too. I know that. Patients can be difficult or hard, but you can't take it out on the patient. We keep telling people again and again, you can't get mad at somebody because they're poor and coming back to the hospital, say Bellevue at NYU, for the sixth time in a month, and they don't know where else to go. I know people get frustrated on the healthcare side, but you got to bite your tongue. But I thought you were headed off in a different direction. Do you remember the doc who was dancing around in the surgery in Atlanta? The woman,
no.
Plastic surgeon, she was doing operations on people, turned on music, and began to kind of boogie around the operating theater. People were dancing, and they had it all on videotape because, as Marjorie just said, everything is taped now in the hospital. They tape it for malpractice protection. They tape it for security. I don't know. They tape it because they can. And so all of a sudden, this thing's up on the Internet, and the next thing, our dancing plastic surgeon is unemployed.
For dancing?
Well, now, yeah.
Wait.
What's dancing? Is it moving slightly back and forth, or is it doing the bump?
Bouncing all over. I mean, like a disco. I mean, jumping, like, it looked like something that might have been on America's Got Talent or something like that. I mean, it was crazy.
Can we stick it back to, but there's a related thing here. I would argue that dancing is not quite as bad as this exchange.
Yeah.
This guy was having an anxiety attack. He's 20 years old here. The doctor thought he was just trying to figure out a way to get narcotic pain relievers. Mm-hmm. Patient says, I can't inhale. She responds laughing. The doctor, he can't inhale. Wow, he must be dead. Are you dead, sir? I mean, the point that you made, obviously I'm not excusing this, particularly if I was the not dead person who couldn't inhale. But like everybody, we get aggravated on our job from time to time. And the beauty of working with someone else is if you're really aggravated, the other person takes over and you mask it. How forgiving should employers be? I mean, often we talk to you, they're far too forgiving of doctors who misbehave. But in situations like this, if this is aberrational rather than part of a trend with a particular doctor, people lose it from time to time, don't they? I mean, that shouldn't be a fatal behavior. I'm not defending it, but you know what I mean. Not like a capital offense.
And let me point out while we're at it that Marjorie and Jim constantly are passing off to one another me in their conversation.
That may be true.
A bitter source of aggravation.
That's right.
That they can barely suppress as we stumble around here. But, you know, it's a maintenance issue. People get mad. People have bad days. People have things going on at home. They bring them into work. I get all that. I'm not even sure I would that this is a fireable thing, muffing off. But it is a you-need-support kind of thing.
Exactly,
so,
I agree.
You know, we got to give them a little more mandatory counseling and then make optional things available to them. You got to support these people. It's tough oftentimes out there. I know everybody thinks, oh, being a doctor, how bad can it be? It must be great to go golfing and, you know, have all the perks of medicine, and some people do have perks, and some people are slogging away as a resident in a pretty tough environment and not getting much appreciation. The system isn't built to support them. It says, tough it out, suck it up, keep going.
Yeah, I don't know. I've watched ER and House and all those doctor TV shows. Mm-hmm. I think the emergency room is pretty tough, don't you think?
Art, do me a favor. Yeah. Can you pep it up a little bit? This is driving me nuts. Put a little more energy in this damn conversation.
Art Kaplan, let me ask you about that. Apparently the physician that was in this embarrassing case of are you dead, sir, she thought that the person was trying to get narcotics.
I said that.
I know. Well, I'm just doing that for the segue to the next segment because
By the way, now they're mad at each other.
That's right. Yeah. This other story talks about the fact that even after overdosing on opioid narcotics, not enough people are getting medicine to treat their addiction.
30% is all?
I don't know what is going on in this country. We have medicines that can reverse addiction. We also have a variety of medicines that you can put people on to help them get off of addictive drugs. They've been around for quite a while, and we have this view. This is where ethics and American values show themselves. We think addiction is willpower. We think addiction is something you have to will yourself to get through. If you went to AA or you went to McLean's or other fancy – well, I shouldn't impugn McLean's. I don't know this is true of them. But some outpatient rehab things where you go for a month or 2 months – they don't use the drugs. They tend to say, we're going to meet in small groups and you're going to admit that, you know, you're an addict and you're going to have to hit rock bottom and then you're going to pray or willpower yourself back to health. Well, that works for some people, but for a lot of people, it would be nice if they also got an injection or a pill. There's something called depot administration where you put kind of a box of the antidote on a person's arm and let it sit there for a month. Why don't we use the antidotes? It's as if we said in diabetes, you have to use your willpower to stop eating bad things, and nope, you can't have any insulin. You've got to think your way out of this. Morally, you're to blame. Doesn't make any sense.
Okay, Art Kaplan, what is on the Everyday Ethics podcast?
Well, I wish we were doing the immorality of the administration's immigration policy, but we'll have to get that next. What we are doing, though, is something tragic. It's the managing the response and worrying about suicide. We kind of built on the Bourdain and Spade celebrity high-visibility suicides, but tried to take on the question of do we know what we're doing? Have we spent enough to prevent suicide? I think suicide is now the leading cause of death, if I'm not mistaken, among teenagers or younger people like 15 to 25. It's a big public health problem. We're not doing what we should for it.
Before you leave, when people like Ronald Reagan had the courage to talk about Alzheimer's, from what I recall, all of a sudden there was much more attention on that sort of thing. And while obviously, the horror of Spade's suicide and Bourdain's are just unimaginable. Will that cause positive focus and potentially resources to be directed at the issues you're talking about in your podcast?
I don't know. I'd like to say yeah, and that high-visibility things in a celebrity culture can move policy,
right.
But they're transient. They really are. And sometimes they do. You get certain situations where a group of people start talking about depression who are celebrities and people begin to say we ought to cover that or spend a little more. But I have a feeling, sadly, that these were kind of objects of curiosity of the week. They had I don't know that they have the sustaining power. It's going to take kind of coming back to the issue again and again to start to drive attention to it. But it is an opportunity to trigger that.
I hope hope it does.
All right, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you.
Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, joins us every week. He's the Drs. William F. and Virginia Comey Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Coming up, the literal price of having an artistic block. Ryan Landry joins us for that and more. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie. And just a little update on something we talked about, I guess, yesterday. Corey Lewandowski, who you'll remember, former campaign manager for Donald Trump, who, when someone was mentioning that a 10-year-old kid with Down syndrome was taken away from her mother, I think it was 2 days ago, said on Fox News, womp, womp. Well, it turns out his Speaker's Bureau, and trust me, guys like that make a lot of money in speeches, his Speaker's Bureau dropped Corey Lewandowski. So in any case, it's time for With Ryan Landry, You Get the Picture. It should probably say, oh, you allegedly get the picture. His recurring segment of social and cultural observations. Today we're talking about Trump's truly, well, we're talking about a lot of things with him. Ryan is a playwright, a lyricist, an actor, a founder of the Gold Dust Orphans Theatrical Company, and we'll tell you where you can see them in their latest, greatest production in starting, actually, in a matter of just days.
Three days
from now. Am I talking to you yet? Just days from now in, well, I'll just say it, a Fisherman Hall, every Sunday from June 24th to September 9th, the great Ryan Landry, whoever
good.
He is.
That's good.
And the Gold Dust
Lion,
Orphans.
Ryan, Randy,
Brooklyn,
I like
Homo.
That.
Nice
right.
to see you, Ryan. How
yeah.
are you?
I'm lying and I'm Randy.
Exactly. That was very good.
I wasn't even thinking
so,
when
you know,
I did it right.
A few minutes ago, Jim and I were talking about Melania Trump, the First Lady, mm-hmm. of course, that she went down after the president's reversal of his position on separating preventing families from children. And she's gone down to visit a center in Texas. And we were praising her for that. But things seem to have gotten a little bit murkier in the time that we issued that praise.
You're telling me.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from that scene down there at the detention facility.
This is an official at the detention facility in McAllen, Texas. Is talking to the First Lady while she's doing this surprise visit. Here he is.
This is their home. You know, and it's, you know, they refer to these as shelters, but it is really a home for the children. This is their house. So their bedrooms are their bedrooms. And as you will see, First Lady, when we do the tour, you'll see the children and you'll see the smiles on their faces and you'll hear them giggle. And it's just fantastic.
No, they love living in a prison with their parents.
I never knew that Melania's voice was that low.
Well, we're playing that now because we were nervous about asking. Jim was nervous about asking, but I'd go boldly where no talk show hosts have gone before and ask you, Ryan, what do you think of Melania?
I think she's a prop.
You do?
But I think she's a smart prop. I think
I do too.
I think she's going to get it all. Stratego!
Yeah. So you think that she's gotten maybe an agreement to stay with him and get more money if she, before she
whatever she's
takes off.
Doing. Yeah. I mean, it must be torturous, but there's got to be a payoff. The woman obviously, you know, idolizes money. I mean, that's obvious.
Can I get back to something much more important than the First Lady?
Yeah.
just
about anything.
You are relatively successful. Is that correct?
I am.
You are relatively talented. Is that correct?
They're relatively, yeah.
And you're relatively creative. Would you agree?
I would say that, yeah.
Okay, so would I. I have to say, this Lion Randy thing that I came up with inadvertently could be your ticket, I think, forever.
Stick to hosting, Jim. I'll stick to the playwriting.
Yeah, because you get some pretty good names for your characters, don't you?
I do, indeed.
Tell us about the play we just saw, Brokolahomo.
Oh, well, we opened. Hey, first I have to tell you who I hung out with on Monday.
Who's that?
None other than Miss Molly Shannon.
Is that true?
That's true.
Where was that?
She came to Showgirls in Provincetown, and we hung out all night, and she co-hosted the show with me, and she's one of my heroes. You
oh
know?
Wow!
So I was after she left, I went to get my makeup off at my friend's house, which I always do. And him and Scott, who is my partner, you know, as you know, they were crying. And when I walked in, I thought something had happened to my grandson or something. I was all freaked out, and I was like, "What's wrong? What happened?" And they're like, "Oh, we're just so happy we got to perform in front of one of our heroes." Of course, it was a case of PBR later.
Okay. So speaking of grandsons,
yeah.
How old is this grandson?
Six.
Six, okay. That's,
oh, that's
a little,
perfect.
That's a little bit young.
Yeah.
But, you know, marijuana is going to be legal in Massachusetts on July 1st. Well, it's legal, I guess, in some degree now, but we're going to be able to go buy it, supposedly, on July 1st somewhere. I'm not sure exactly
where
we're
going to
go.
Well, it's not clear. They may be granted. Can you find out if they have actually had the meeting and granted the first license today?
Yeah.
Because theoretically that was happening. But go ahead. I'm sorry, Margaret.
But there was a great piece in the Globe about would you smoke pot in front of the kids? Now, six, they may not be too young to know what's going on, but would you – suppose your grandchild or your kid was like – 14.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I would probably if they were 14.
You would?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I don't smoke a lot of pot, though. Yeah. I'm a real booze hound.
You're a real booze hound?
Yeah.
You see, I feel differently about it because it's legal. You know, it's.
I mean, how you felt a month ago?
Well,
is that what you mean?
I think because you can't really be lecturing your children about, you know, the perils of marijuana if you are. Imbibing.
I thought the Globe story, I
understood.
I thought it was ridiculous. With all due respect, I'm not sure who wrote it, so I'm not attacking the writer, I guess, but maybe I am.
It was kind of long.
It is long, but it's legal on July 1st.
Right.
So if
that makes it different,
though.
If
you don't want to smoke in front of your kid, then you shouldn't drink in front of your kid either.
I agree totally.
But that's my point.
They should be treated as the same thing.
No, that's my point. It's legal now, so it takes away the mom or dad is doing a bad thing in front of the kids. But when it was illegal, I think it was, you probably couldn't do it. Maybe you could do it if they were like 30, but if they were 14 and you're lecturing them, you can't very well be back with the bong in the back porch.
Sound like a little guilt on Marjorie's part there. Lion Randy or Ryan? I mean, Ryan Landry.
Did you smoke pot, Marjorie, did you ever smoke pot?
I have smoked pot. Yes, I have.
Yeah. Excuse me. Wait.
I'm looking forward to July 1st.
Have you ever?
When you become legal.
Yeah, that's right.
He said,
once
have
or
you
twice.
Ever smoked pot?
Once or twice. Back in college.
By the way, not only
are young and irresponsible.
It got so bad that during the campaign, when Commissioner Bill Evans, who we're quite fond of, was here and was telling us why he was opposing the ballot question, and Marjorie said she's really upset when she ended up at the old age home, she wanted to be able to smoke. He said, even if the ballot question was defeated, he would make sure that she got deliveries. This is the police commissioner
yeah.
of Boston.
Well, you know, gravy. I mean, one of these days I'll be in the old folks' home and I'll be in a rocking chair. I think it might be very nice. I don't have to worry about it now because it is, in fact, legal to get marijuana.
Why is alcohol your drug of choice?
I guess because, you know, I'm an old schooler and I just got, you know, because I work at bars and I get them for free.
Yes. Yeah. And alcohol is more social anyway.
Yeah, well,
more social.
I mean, I think that not really because
you
the kids
so?
After the show, all the kids in Orphans after the show always go out back and smoke pot.
They do?
Always do, yeah. And tons of it. And I'm a one hit wonder.
Yeah.
I take one hit and I wonder why I did it.
But I'm bummed.
Well, that's what they say now, that you only need to take one hit because the marijuana is so powerful.
Oh, my God.
Which you will all find out on July 1st.
It's like the funk of 40,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Assuming we can get there. I'm concerned about there's not going to be any place to go get it in July 1st.
Well, Andrew Cabral, who is the CEO of one of these companies, Ascend, said she doesn't even think they get their application in until the fall, and then it could be 5 months after it's granted, should it be, and that sort of thing.
Well, it's going to take a while. You know, I mean, come on. How long ago was it that you got arrested for it? So it's going to take a while.
I've never been arrested for it.
You haven't?
Thank goodness.
No, I didn't ask if you got arrested for it.
Were you?
Was that like a
Were you?
No. I did everything. I did it all. Everything from... I always said I made a terrible junkie because I forgot to shoot up every day. But I was... You know, it's always... I'm so cheap.
The kids are
it's
with
always
you in the car,
what's free.
You
and
right,
it's always that? Free Coke at the club, right? So I get that for free. And the booze is free. So, of course, you develop some sort of a habit. But then it's sort of like it's so expensive. You know, I dealt mushrooms for a while way back when.
Really?
But here's what I did. It was so stupid. I didn't get, because I was in Provincetown, I didn't really get that it was illegal or I didn't care or I thought it was such an outlaw. So there were other drug dealers in town. I said, well, I have to be special. So I put my mushrooms in little cellophane bags and I took a rubber stamp that said Ryan Landry, superstar. And I stamped it and cut them all out and taped them to the bags and would take them and put them in a Stop and Shop bag and tie it to my belt loop and go around the dance floor going mushrooms, 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 and sold them. Wow. Well, that's how I bought my first house, actually. But... I mean, what a doofus to do that, right?
Yes.
But, you know, I just, you know, back then, I also used to jump through flaming hoops, you know, because I wanted to make my name in New York as a drag performer. I won't say drag artist, but I had to make my way. So I would jump through flaming hoops. I'd take the flaming hoop. Actually, take a hula hoop and wrap it in cotton and then soak it in lighter fluid. And then would hang it from a wire coat hanger from the ceiling of the club, and then I would light it, and then I'd do a song, and I'd jump through, and the audience would catch me. But this one time, I was really hungover, as I said, booze hound, and I connected the hoop to the ceiling with twine, not even thinking. And, of course, it burned through the twine, and the hoop bounced off the stage, and it landed on this girl, and her dress caught on fire, and then these drag queens who were dressed as ghosts, and I don't know why, came into the Pyramid Club on Avenue A and sprayed everybody with the fire extinguisher, and after that, I stopped with the flaming hoop.
You know what's unbelievable?
Oh, my God, her dress caught on fire.
We got to take a break, but you know what is an incredible coincidence?
What's incredible?
The exact same thing happened to me last week. Is that unbelievable? I let a hoop set a hoop on.
You're jealous of my lifestyle.
It's Lion Randy. I can't get over this now. This is like,
okay.
I really hit on something.
We're not talking to Lion Randy.
No, we're not.
Or Landry. We're talking to Ryan Landry. I'm going to keep talking to him after this quick
Yay!
Break. You listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH, made possible thanks to listener contributions. Your support of just $10 or $20 a month keeps all these great conversations coming your way. Please take a moment to give now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424. And thanks.
Okay, we have 17 minutes left in the show.
17.
And we really appreciate whatever you can donate during this time. We have a wonderful gift.
We do.
As we mentioned before, these are Bluetooth earbuds, $10 a month. They are magnetic.
Wireless.
They are wireless. They have wonderful sound. But most important, they are magnetic, which means they will not get tangled. And that's a really great asset.
So can, you can I offer tickets to the show, too?
Wait a second.
Wait a minute.
Turn
Ryan
on the mic.
He's going to offer tickets to the show. Tell people what your show is.
The show is called Broklahoma.
It ran
in Boston to rave reviews. And now it's going to open on Sunday night at 7:30 at Fisherman Hall, which is the old Provincetown High School in Provincetown. And if you are a supporter of GBH and you send me a message, I will make sure I give you free tickets for opening night. How's that?
That's
wonderful.
Oh, my God. Okay, how do you send a message to Ryan Landry?
Oh, you know. Should I give my phone number?
Actually, send us the email, bprwgbh.org.
And we'll see.
That's pretty generous, actually.
That's very generous.
But you got to say that you donated something, by the way, to do that, because we don't want to do it just out of the goodness of his heart.
Well, I also have to remember that I'm not just doing this out of the goodness of my heart, because I run the bar, too.
So. That's a very beautiful. Good point. Thank you. Who's doing this, him or us?
888-897-9424, wgbhnews.org.
And the more important part than fabulous tickets and this great earbuds thing. Again, $10 a month or $120 in one pop for these terrific earbuds that really work well. I don't endorse anything that doesn't work well. I don't like that. They work fabulously. The sound is great. What was my point? Oh, my point was that Marjorie wants you to give in the next 15 minutes or else there's going to be some sort of performance depression. Tommy in Acton, thank you. Linda in Franklin. Kimberly in Sounderstown? I don't know it. Rhode Island. But thank you anyway, Kimberly. Nancy in Reading and Holly in Cambridge. We appreciate it from all of you. Get with it. I mean, I am telling you, this is day one. There's nothing better than getting your giving over, if you intend to do giving, than doing it on day one and doing it during our show at 888-897-9424. Or just go for like 90 seconds to wgbhnews.org.
We want to thank Paula in Sandwich, Peter in Plymouth, Kathleen in Fitchburg. Thank you very, very much to those three and to everybody else who's taken the time to give. It does really mean a lot to us, actually. And there's 14 minutes left in our show.
How much you love when you read names of people who decide, in all seriousness for a second, when you read a name of somebody who has taken the time to give hard-earned money because they support what we and our colleagues do, is that not a great feeling?
Yeah,
I'm serious.
It makes
it's huge.
Me feel very happy. That's why I emphasize during our show is really the best time to do it.
888-897-9424,
wgbhnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're talking to the great Ryan Landry. And if you're tuning in, he's a playwright. I assume you know who he is. Ryan Landry is a genius, in my opinion. And he is the driving force between the great Gold Dust Orphans, who you can see in Provincetown starting this Sunday.
That's right.
So I read this interesting story. Hugh Hefner is no longer with us. As you know, he started the great Playboy magazine. His son now, who's 25 or 26.
26.
Hef Jr. is trying to bring the Playboy and the whole organization to the modern age because, you know, it seems sort of 50s, 60s kind of thing.
No more nudity. Isn't that the
decision? No, he wants to bring it back.
He does?
Yeah.
But I totally agree with him. But I think there's a new kind of nudity. I mean, what they were talking about is how Hugh sort of, like, he was getting really old. He could probably hardly see the bunnies in front of him, right? And they were all spray tanned and all, like, their hair were just, like, rotten to the core, you know? But now they're doing more natural looking ladies who are posing. And I think, I've always been all for nudity. I think the female body is the most beautiful thing created. And I also believe in this sort of like James Bondy style. It certainly beats the doofuses that beat their wives over the head with beer cans at football games.
Well, I think that's probably true.
You mean the James Bond style models?
I just mean a gentleman. Sex is, you can still think about sex and be a gentleman, and I think it's kind of a great thing. And I think it you know, like all the suave de vivre, is that a word?
Yeah.
Let's just pretend that it is. That I mean, Obama was very much like a Hugh Hefner, I thought.
In what way?
He just
was totally cool.
But he was sexy, I thought.
I thought he was sexy.
But let me ask you something, being a gay guy. A lot of little boys, this was their big thrill to go get Playboy.
I used to steal Playboy.
So when you're a gay kid growing up.
What do you steal?
I stole Twizzlers. I stole Twizzlers. Listen, here's the deal. The only time I ever got caught stealing, okay, and I never did it again. So I went in. My friends told me, you're going to steal something and we're going to steal something. So they stole something and ran. Well, I was, you know, kind of a chubby kid and I didn't run so fast. And I stole some Twizzlers. And so I ran out and the lady chased me.
Oh,
and I mean
horrible.
Down the street, through the woods, over a log, over a ravine, in the brush, finally tackled me and said, do you know what you did? And she's digging her nails deep into my arm. And I said, hey, it's only licorice. And she goes, it's not licorice. It's strawberry Twizzlers.
Oh,
and
no.
She scared me so much that I never stole again.
Is that really true?
What happened?
True.
Oh. Did she haul you back to the store and make you tell your parents?
She let me go, and then I went home. I was so upset. I was bawling my eyes out. You know, I was such a dummy. And I told my mother, and my mother made me go back there and apologize to her.
Oh, that's pretty good.
You told your mother?
I told my mother.
Wow.
Well, because,
impressive.
You know, I had those nail marks in my arm.
Yeah.
It looked like I'd been in a fight with a cat.
You
know,
I didn't tell my mother. Did you tell your mother?
What? That I stole? Mom, I want you to know I stole 12 Playboy magazines this afternoon. They're under my mattress, and you shouldn't go near my mattress, if you know what I mean. Oh, yeah, I told her that.
My mother knew better
out of
than
your
you
mind?
My mattress.
By the way, do you know I literally stuck them in my pants? I mean, it is, I honest to God, I would slide the magazines into my
pants. It's an original idea.
My father was going to give me a beating, and I knew it with the belt. And so I took a checkerboard, and I folded it up and put it in the back of my pants. And when I got when I was ready to get the belt, and he saw it, he hit it once and wondered what it was, and then saw it and made me pull it out, and then he just laughed and let me alone.
Well, that's
wasn't that great?
That's a pretty
your
good story.
Your father shouldn't
too.
Have hit you with a belt.
Oh, you know, I'm listen. It was that's how they were. It's all fine. I'm fine.
Okay.
It wasn't that bad. It was like, you know, it was the symbol of discipline for them. I mean, I don't believe in it for my grandchildren, but you know, I mean, when I was growing up, that's the time. That
you
was
know,
the time.
Ryan Lander, I was thinking about you this morning. Margie and I were reading about the story about how there are some social scientist types who say that people have Netflix addictions, that they watch it so incessantly if they're not watching cable news. But what it made me think of, whether you're guilty or not, I didn't know that was the answer to the question. I don't think I've ever asked you in all the time I've known you, what do you watch? I mean, we know what you do, which is unlike anything else.
Jeremy
what do you watch?
Brent. Jeremy Brent in Sherlock Holmes, the old BBC series. I watch them over and over
I
and over
I love
again.
Those.
And
he's
I watch...
a big fan of the new ones, not me.
Benedict Cumberbatch is a genius. You don't
I like the
Benedict
old ones.
Cumberbatch?
I don't like new things. Him. I checked out of Society in 1979, and I haven't looked back.
Since
I'm
that woman dug
Brent,
her fingers
though.
Into your arms, I think it was roughly about that time. So
me.
Other than the old Sherlock Holmes, I'm serious. Like, what do you say? I can't wait till I see X. What do you watch?
I love this story. This show called Nashville. It actually got canceled. It only has
a couple more
episodes left. Yeah. But it's the worst. Like, what's really great is you can watch it and you can say, taxi cab pulls up. Girl turns around, single tear, and you can like say that, and then it all happens on the screen.
This is Connie Britton,
it's so predictable. Well, she left the show.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But it's so predictable that it's just a really fun thing for me to watch. I don't know why.
So you're not one of these Netflix addicts that sit there and watches 6 hours.
I do. The Staircase. Have you seen The Staircase?
No. Is that good?
You need to watch that. It shouldn't be 13 episodes, but it is pretty interesting, and it was great. I loved Evil Genius. Did you see that?
No, I don't think
so. No, there's shows for you, Jim.
I'm guilty. I'm a Netflix addict, and I will continue to be one.
It's okay. Jim's a Netflix addict, too, aren't you?
I am, but I'm writing Evil Genius. Hey,
Ryan,
it's great to see you.
Thank you very
much. Love you guys.
Thank you
Provincetown.
Yes.
Brooklahoma, Sunday night at 7:30.
That's right. He's the founder of Goldust Orphans, and Brooklahoma is now playing in Provincetown.
And it is beyond huge fun. The whole BPR team went 2 weeks ago. We loved every second.
So thank you for tuning in to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, join our all-stars of the Boston Public Library, Emily Rooney, Callie Crossey, and Shirley Lee Young. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni, and our engineer, John the Claw Parker. What's on television, Jim Brady?
A couple of things. One, we're going to talk about whether something you and I started, but what is the political impact, if any, of on Donald Trump of the first maybe major misstep, even with his own key constituency, to a local woman who did this stunning film about persecution and sexual violence perpetrated against Rohingya women from Myanmar who are now in Bangladesh is just unbelievably horrible, and I think it'll open your eyes. And the great Kelly Beatty from Star and Telescope is going to talk about The Space Force that Donald Trump wants to start.
Oh, yeah, Space Force.
That's it tonight.
Okay, I am Marjorie
Eden. I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you very much for donating today. We hope to see you tomorrow.